You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. In Monday night's Punch and Judy show, the first scheduled debate between presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, there was no mention of the record-breaking $38 billion gift package to Israel that President Obama announced 2 weeks ago. In fact, the only reference to Israel was Trump's remark that he had met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday, as had Clinton, who decided not to take opportunity to mention it, although at the time she gave her blessings to what had been euphemistically labeled by the White House as a memorandum of understanding between Washington and Tel Aviv. The decision of moderator Lester Holt not to inquire about the candidate's position on the latest giveaway to Israel should not have been surprising and was a favor to both. That's because there's no way that either Clinton or Trump could have justified it in the eyes of the majority of the American people, who are repeatedly being told that there's not enough money in the government's coffers to pay for many of the essentials, the absence of which impacts their lives. Joining in this conspiracy of silence has been NPR, which relies on congressional appropriations for a major part of its funding, and Congress, as I have pointed out on more than one occasion, is perhaps Israel's most important occupied territory. The pressures of funding also affect Democracy Now!, which only mentioned it briefly in passing yesterday or Monday in reporting Trump's meeting with Netanyahu. While Democracy Now! Has provided outstanding and unparalleled coverage of the resistance by the Sioux and their allies to oil drilling in North Dakota, and is on the scene in all the cities where black men and youths have been murdered by police, Amy Goodman, too, must think about her own sources of funds when the power of the Israel lobby is part of the story. Fortunately, this is not the case with me, Takes on the World, or KZYX, which for nearly 16 years has given me the freedom to do the kind of programming that I do, while acknowledging before every program that my views are purely my own and not the station's. That's why today I'll be speaking about that massive arms package for Israel with a frequent guest, former CIA field officer and analyst Phil Giraldi, who just yesterday penned an article on the subject for the UNS Review entitled, appropriately, Israel's $38 billion scam. That will be 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that, while in the meantime I'll provide you with some other information on that subject which you probably haven't heard. In his article, Giraldi notes that groveling to Israel is in the American political DNA. Even progressive groups that claim to be supportive of Palestinian rights and opposed to growing fascism in Israel exhibit the usual ambivalence when it comes to issues that might actually have an impact, he writes. They go silent and become curiously absent from the debate, end quote. By coincidence, this was the subject of an article of my own that appeared Monday on Dissident Voice, entitled Bennis's Delusions of Massive Opposition to Israel Evaporate Under Harsh Light of Reality, end quote. The Bennis I refer to, of course, is Phyllis Bennis, who is considered one of the experts on the Middle East and appears regularly on Democracy Now! And on the Real News Network, one of the best alternative news sources. She was also my guest on the very first edition of Takes on the World back in January 2001. What prompted my article was her comment in an interview on the Real News Network on September 14th, the day that Obama announced the arms deal for Israel, and she said, quote, "There is massive opposition to Israeli actions in the United States today, particularly importantly in the Jewish community, where there's been an enormous shift in the discourse," end quote. I was bewildered by that statement since it is profoundly untrue, and one only had to look at the absence of any opposition to the $38 billion arms package, despite the fact that it had been discussed in the Israeli and U.S. media for more than a year before Obama's announcement. She then went on to portray the elimination in the Democratic Platform Committee of statements critical of Israeli occupation and the ongoing construction of Jewish settlements as a victory. As a victory. Here's what I found mind-boggling, she said, quote, "The public discourse on the subject has shifted," she said. "We saw that during the debate over the language on Israel and Palestine in the Democratic Party platform," end quote. Does she take us for fools? Apparently so, but I'm not sure how many more victories like that the Palestinians can afford. If you wish to read my entire article, do an online search for Blankfort, Bennis, and Dissident Voice in any order. You'll find it. What's equally astonishing about the latest gift to Israel is that two of Israel's leading political figures who enjoy favorable opinions on Capitol Hill, former Prime Minister Ehud Barak and recently fired Defense Minister Moshe Bugi Yalon, had the nerve to attack Netanyahu for not getting even more money. Seriously. Writing in the Washington Post on the day before the deal was announced, Barak first attacked Netanyahu for having, quote, enabled a militant nationalist minority to carry out a hostile takeover of his party, Likud, to form a majority in his cabinet and thus to hijack our national agenda in the service of a messianic drive toward, as is often put, a single Jewish state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, end quote. And he said, Netanyahu's reckless conduct, he went on, has also undermined Israel's security. Israel has reached a new military aid agreement for the next decade with the United States. The damage produced by Netanyahu's irresponsible management of the relations with the White House is now fully manifest. Israel will receive $3.8 billion a year, an important contribution to our security, Barak acknowledged, but far less than what would have been obtained before the prime minister chose to blatantly interfere with U.S. politics. End quote. He then went on to complain that with a rise in the cost of weaponry since the last 10-year plan, the fact that the current deal represents a $700 billion annual increase, quote, the newly agreed-upon amount represents no greater purchasing power, and even these funds will be conditioned on Israel refraining from requesting additional funding from Congress, end quote. This was apparently intended by Obama to stem Israel's greed by throwing a monkey wrench into its traditional ability to manipulate Congress whenever it wishes. Additionally, complained Barak, Israel will have to accept a gradual reduction of more than $750 million a year in funds for our defense industries. Consequently, either vital security projects will be canceled or the same amount will be reduced from important domestic programs. End quote. I should point out Israel's domestic programs include free health care and higher education, which he and other Israelis apparently believe the U.S. should subsidize. Those words are Ehud Barak's. The next day, former Defense Minister Yalon spoke to the Washington Institute for Middle East Studies, a 30-year-old AIPAC-spawned think tank which Yalon joined in Washington after being fired from his post. As the English-language Times of Israel reported, Yalon joined Barak Thursday in questioning the military aid deal, saying the $38 billion, Washington's largest defense package to any country in history, is still not enough to meet all of Israel's security needs. The former defense minister, who was effectively ousted from his position earlier this year amid a political crisis that saw Avigdor Lieberman, a one-time Moldavian beer hall bouncer with no military experience, take his place, he suggested that while the deal saw Israel receive all the capabilities he had negotiated for in 2015, the sum total of the package still fell short. Put it another way, said Yalon, I don't think $38 billion will provide all the required capabilities or meet all our needs. Israel will now have to go through a prioritization process to see what we can get and what we prefer to leave aside, he added. Well, it might not turn out as badly for Israel as Barak and Yalon projected to be. Led by Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, the ninth poorest state in the union with a poverty rate of 18.6% and a childhood poverty rate of 27.3%, there are a handful of members of Congress who are ready to respond to Barak and Yalon by arguing that Israel should get yet more than the $38 billion. Moreover, they want the U.S. to restore the provision that had been in previous arms packages to Israel that would allow it to spend at least a quarter of the money on its own weapons industry that is now competing with the U.S. in the global arms market. Reuters reported that Graham and three other Republican senators announced last Tuesday that they would seek to overturn parts of the military aid agreement with Israel, setting up a showdown with Obama over the final outcome of the package. Graham, with Kelly Ayotte, John McCain, and Ted Cruz, told a news conference they wanted to add a measure giving Israel an additional $1.5 billion in military aid to a bill expected later this year to renew U.S. sanctions on Iran. Arguing that Congress, not the administration, sets spending policy under U.S. law, they objected to a provision in the agreement that would prevent Israel from asking for additional funds from Congress after the new Memorandum of Understanding begins at the end of fiscal 2018. the beginning of fiscal 2018. This is a very dramatic moment in the U.S.-Israel relationship between Congress and the State of Israel, declared Graham. Congress is not going to sit on the sidelines, end quote. The four senators also object to Israel's agreement to return any money if Congress tries to send in more than $3.8 billion per year before then. Graham also said he would introduce legislation to overturn a provision in the agreement that phased out the special arrangement previously noted that has allowed Israel for decades to use 26.3% of the U.S. aid on its own defense industry instead of on U.S. weapons. After more than 10 months of often bitter negotiations, Netanyahu decided it would be best to forge a new arrangement with Obama, who leaves office in January, rather than hoping for better terms from the next U.S. administration, according to officials on both sides. The senators insisted that Netanyahu had been forced into signing because they claim that Israel's archenemy, Iran, is growing stronger as it obtains billions of dollars unfrozen under the nuclear agreement reached last year. Now is not the time to say they were going to nickel and dime Israel, Graham said. Well, that fate apparently is reserved for the people of his home state and the rest of the United States. Since then, Senators Marco Rubio, Mark Kirk, and Roy Blunt have added their names to the bill that is now starting to move through the Senate. I'll try and keep you posted on this story because you're not likely to hear about it from anyone else. Speaking of the Senate, you probably haven't heard, but on September 19th, 88 senators, including both Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, as well as vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine, signed a letter drafted by AIPAC to President Obama, calling on him to, quote, make it clear that you will veto any one-sided U.N. Security Council resolution that may be offered in the coming months, end quote. I told you Congress was Israeli occupied, didn't I? While on the subject of U.S. arms for Israel, I neglected to mention that following the announcement of the arms deal, the U.S. Air Force confirmed the transfer of an additional 10 Boeing F-15D fighters to Israel at no cost to Tel Aviv. The 10 F-15Ds, which cost the taxpayers, U.S. taxpayers, $28 million a pop, are considered excess articles and not counted as foreign military sales. The USAF has delivered 8 to Israel so far, according to the website Flight Global. Well, this is as good a time as any, I guess, to inject a little humor, admittedly dark humor, into this commentary. Last Thursday night at New York's prestigious Plaza Hotel, the Hudson Institute honored Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu with his 2016 Herman Kahn Award, which is presented to leading public servants who exemplify a commitment to Western alliances as a bedrock of global security, prosperity, and freedom. Their words, not mine. I expect most of you are old enough to remember Stanley Kubrick's 1979 film, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Well, Dr. Strangelove, of course, was modeled after the Hudson Institute's founder, Herman Kahn, the military strategist and physicist who, while working with the RAND Corporation, advocated the theory during the Cold War that a nuclear war with the Soviet Union was winnable, not unthinkable. His title of Dr. Strangelove was later passed on to Henry Kissinger, who himself had been a Herman Kahn Award winner, as were Ronald Reagan, Rupert Murdoch, Dick Cheney, and Joseph Lieberman. I think there are a few people who would argue that Netanyahu is not deserving to be linked with such world-famous luminaries. The biggest luminary Monday night's debate in terms of girth as well as wealth was the uber-rich Las Vegas-based billionaire Sheldon Adelson. Earlier in the year, Adelson had promised Donald Trump $100 million for his campaign, but until recently there had been no sign of it. Now there's an unconfirmed report that he will provide Trump with a mere $25 million to help him through Election Day, since Donald has changed his tune regarding Israel, whose welfare is Adelson's prime political concern. Earlier in the campaign, Trump stated that he would, quote, be even-handed in his treatment of the Israelis and Palestinians, an act of political naivete that he made sure to reverse. The statement, that's reversal of the statement, the change of heart, were received with indifference by his political base, but not by potential supporters among America's Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, where his right-wing racist views toward Muslims and Mexican immigrants have been warmly welcomed. But this item is not about Trump, but about one of his leading advisors, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who was seen at the debate literally kissing Adelson's ring. It was probably done in jest, wrote Douglas Bloomfield, a former AIPAC staff member in the Jerusalem Post. but may have been intended to help shake loose some of Sheldon's shekels for Trump. Well, finally, we have Facebook coming out, so to speak, as another Israeli asset. For some time, the number of people who have had their accounts blocked by Facebook for posting criticism of Israel, which could no way be construed as anti-Semitic, has been on the increase, as I heard from friends and relatives. Finally, it happened to me when I responded to a post on a Facebook page accusing a well-known Israeli-born critic of his country's racist policies, former Takes on the World guest Miko Peled, of being the favorite of racists and white supremacists. For suggesting in reply that Peled's attacker was, quote, doing damage control for AIPAC, I found myself blocked for 24 hours for violating Facebook's community standards with no functioning means of appeal. In Israel, Facebook has been cooperating with Israeli authorities to suppress the social media tool as a means of communication and organizing resistance where numerous checkpoints make moving from village to village close to impossible. In 2015, Facebook took down 431 pieces of content that it said violated harassment laws or denied the Holocaust, which is against the law in Israel. And in Facebook's report on government requests shows that last year it handed overuse of data to Israeli authorities for about 60% of the 468 requests it received. In Norway, Facebook faced a storm from the readers of Aftenposten, the country's leading newspaper, when it deleted a post by writer Tom Egeland that featured the terror of war, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph by Nick Ut that showed children, including the naked 9-year-old Kim Fook, running away from U.S. napalm attack during the Vietnam War. You've probably seen it. Egeland was subsequently suspended from Facebook. When Aftenposten reported on the suspension, using the same photograph it then shared on its Facebook page, the newspaper received a message from Facebook asking it to either remove or pixelize the photograph. Any photographs of people displaying a fully nude genitalia or buttocks or fully nude female breasts will be removed, the notice on Facebook explains. Before Aftenposten could respond, Facebook deleted the article and image from the newspaper's Facebook page. At 10 a.m. Sunday morning, October 9th, in celebration of John Lennon's birthday, there will be a live international speak out against political censorship by Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, at his San Francisco mansion, 3452 21st Street near Dolores Street. So they're going to get in Mark Zuckerberg's face. The theme will be Imagine a Day Without Censorship, and it'll be live streamed. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, in discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We have been celebrating the way in which oppressed peoples are seeing the commonality of the struggles of others around the globe and are rising up in support of each other. Whether it is around the issue of incarceration, police abuse, blatant discrimination, or land confiscation, hands are being extended around the world to challenge all forms of oppression. A marvelous example of this, the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee, called the BNC, has written the following statement of support to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe which is fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline being constructed by the Energy Transfer Partners Corporation. The largest coalition in Palestinian civil society that leads the global BDS movement sends a message of solidarity to the sovereign Standing Rock Sioux tribe. The people of Palestine support you and all those standing with you right now in North Dakota to protect your tribal lands and resist the desecration and destruction of your sacred burial sites at the hands of the Energy Transfer Partners Corporation and the Dakota Access Pipeline they are building. The BNC supports the restoration of all lands guaranteed by treaty to the Standing Rock Sioux and all other indigenous nations. As indigenous Palestinians, we pledge to stand in solidarity with indigenous peoples around the world, including in Turtle Island, in their struggles for justice, determination, restoration of rights, and respect for their heritage. Palestinians understand all too well how settler colonial authorities use resource extraction and other economic and bureaucratic pretenses as a way to solidify control over indigenous land and dispossess indigenous people. When we look at Standing Rock, we see our indigenous sisters and brothers defending their land, their identity, their dignity, and their heritage. Your response to the pipeline project defends not only the rights of all those who utilize the watershed of the Missouri River from potential environmental catastrophe, it ultimately defends all of us from continued fossil fuel extraction at a time when climate change threatens us all. When we look at Standing Rock, we also see the attempts of authorities with a still prevalent colonial mentality to vilify, criminalize, and ultimately disappear indigenous peoples on their own land. The Palestinian people have firsthand experience with the colonial power desecrating our burial sites, destroying our indigenous communities, and appropriating our culture and otherwise gradually erasing our centuries-old heritage. Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid, with the help of the U.S.-based Simon Wiesenthal Center, has ruthlessly destroyed and desecrated large portions of the ancient Palestinian Mamilla Cemetery in Jerusalem to build the so-called Museum of Tolerance, without any sense of irony. Mamilla is a Muslim burial ground and holy site believed to date back to the 7th century. Numerous Sufi saints and thousands of other Arab officials, scholars, notables, and Jerusalem Palestinian families, including companions of the Prophet Muhammad, have been buried in the cemetery over the last 1,000 years. Since 2010, the Center for Constitutional Rights in the United States and the Campaign to Preserve Mamilla Cemetery, led by Palestinian figures with direct connections to some of those buried in Mamilla, have worked to halt construction of the new facility and preserve what remains of the site. The BDS movement has learned much from and has been profoundly inspired by the history of resistance to other settler colonial projects, such as the more than 500 years of indigenous resistance to the genocidal European colonialism in the Western Hemisphere, including the United States. Your tribe and your many allies are part of a grand tradition of resilience and resistance in the face of dispossession of ancestral lands, cultural destruction, forced relocation and ethnic cleansing, brutal wars, and genocide. We owe the indigenous people of Turtle Island a great debt for lighting the way and showing what it means to resiliently resist colonialism generation after generation for more than half a millennium. The BNC was dismayed but not surprised to learn that the multinational security corporation G4S has been contracted to provide security services for the pipeline construction on your land by Energy Transfer Partners. G4S is involved in human rights abuses around the world, including in Palestine, where the company provides services to illegal Israeli colonies, to military checkpoints, and to prisons that are infamous for using torture and inhumane treatment against Palestinian prisoners, including children. We are particularly horrified to learn that on September 4th, defenders of your ancestral land were attacked with dogs and pepper spray, a chemical weapon used by a different private security company hired to protect pipeline construction. The BNC calls for intensifying worldwide boycott and divestment campaigns against G4S and all private security companies that violate our human rights and use weapons and violence against the indigenous people whose land they are operating on and against oppressed communities the world over. Once again, violence and brutality are being used to attempt to control the people standing up for their land, their culture, and the earth. Once again, the resistance will not be contained or curtailed by the violence and intimidation tactics of the oppressors. The BNC is committed to building stronger ties of solidarity between our peoples and movements, and we will work with our partners in North America to make this a reality. From Palestine to Standing Rock, we shall stand united against colonialism, corporate criminality, and for all our inalienable rights to freedom, justice, and equality. That was a statement of solidarity sent from the Palestinian BDS National Committee to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North America. And now on to our feature presentation this morning. It is a presentation given by Miko Peled. Miko was born in Jerusalem in 1961 into a well-known Zionist family. His grandfather was a Zionist leader and signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father, Mati Peled, was a young officer in the War of 1948 and a general in the War of 1967 when Israel conquered the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai. But Miko has a different vision for Israel and for the Palestinian people, as you will hear. And now here is Miko Peled speaking at the Church Center for the United Nations in New York City.
I just got back about 2 weeks ago from Palestine. And I have to say, this particular visit was probably more difficult than most. Because the reality, the pressure under which Palestinians live and the blatant disregard on the part of Israel for Palestinian life and the reality in which Palestinians live is almost hard to describe in words. And now we have this book, and I see it as a great opportunity to do two things. First of all, tell the story, which people listen to, and that's a good thing. Many people say, well, if a Palestinian said this, nobody would be listening. So I'm glad to have that platform. And the other thing, which I think is really missing from the conversation here in this country, although it's improving, is context. We very rarely hear about this issue with context. So suddenly Palestinians are stabbing people. Suddenly there's, rockets flying out of Gaza. Suddenly this happens. But there's never any context. And what the book allows me to do and what I do in these in talks is to put together the context and kind of a timeline, how it began, where we stand today, and how do we move forward. And I'd like to start with a couple of questions. So the first question is, you know, are Palestine and Israel one country or two? Is the reality on the ground there one that is of war, or is it a struggle for freedom and justice? Is the way to achieve our goal, is it something we do through peace talks, or is what required resistance? I think these are really, really important questions to ask, especially like Helena was mentioning, we're right across the street from the United Nations, and now we've got the Palestinian flag that was raised there a few months ago. Because I think this is a big part of the context. This is a big part of moving forward and understanding where we stand. We hear people say, I visited Israel and I visited Palestine. And we hear people, or we hear countries that have been recognizing the state of Palestine. And so I always ask, well, where is this state of Palestine? I mean, the country is obviously the same country. It has two names. We have Israelis and Palestinians who live there, so two nations. But where is this state that people talk about? What are its boundaries? Who are its citizens? You know, these are questions that are really important. And then, again, is what we're trying to achieve achievable through peace talks, or is it going to require resistance? And then what does resistance look like? And unless we touch on each and every one of these issues, I think we're never going to be able to move forward. Now, a requisite for, or prerequisite for understanding this is also, like I said, the context. And again, if we don't put it in some kind of historical context, then we're never going to be able to solve the problem. And I would say that it's fair to claim that the reason there's a problem in Palestine is because of racism and colonialism that came to Palestine from Europe. And when we look at the history of how things developed, then we have what everybody knows, I think most people are familiar with, is this thing called the Balfour Declaration, which in Israel is considered almost like one of the Ten Commandments. You think it came down the mountain with Moses. It was, you know, every street, every city in Israel has a Balfour Street. So you think, well, who is this Balfour? Who is this saint or prophet? And what did he say? And what is this Balfour Declaration? You know? And when we look right at it, it's basically Lord Balfour, who's the Foreign Secretary of Britain, promising a Jewish millionaire by the name of Rothschild Palestine for the Jewish people. And there were very few Jewish people in Palestine, and neither Rothschild nor Balfour had lived or, you know, had anything to do with Palestine. But this was the reality where white people could just take brown people's land and do what they wanted with it. And this is another example of that. And then the United Nations intervenes, and we have the partition plan. And unless we understand this partition plan, again, there's no way to understand how we got to where we are today and what came after that. And these are things that when we have the normal dialogue groups and the normal kind of conversations between Israelis and Palestinians, Israelis usually do not want to discuss. They do not want to discuss that part of the history. They always say we need to look forward, we need to move on beyond that. And I think we have to discuss it, so I'm going to discuss it. And if we look at the partition plan, you know, this is a map of the partition plan which the United Nations passed. I have to assume that whoever drew this map must have been on drugs or hungover or something, because it's an absurd map. The boundaries are obviously, you know, completely unachievable. But besides that, as we can see, they divided the country into a large part and a small part, a bigger country and a smaller country. And there's this impression here in America, and I think generally around the world, the Jews have always lived there. You know, that has always been populated by Jews. That today, citizens of Israel, we are the descendants of the ancient Israelites, and we've always been there. And what people don't realize, when this plan was put together, there were less, or maybe just about 500,000 or half a million Jews living in Palestine. Most of them were, like my grandparents, Jews who came to colonize, who had arrived, you know, in the 40 or 50 years prior to that. And then the first generation Israelis, which were my parents' generation. That was it. Now, the vast majority of the population, at least three times as many, were the local Palestinians. And they were given the smaller portion. So the United Nations gave the larger portion of the land to a small community of immigrants or colonizers who just got off the boat, basically. And then, of course, the expectation that this was going to work is absurd. But what's even more important about this, or equally important, is how we interpret what happened next. And this is the pillar of the conflict. This is the main, these are the main pillars upon which this conflict rests. It's how we interpret what happened from that moment on. So the story that I was raised upon and the story that we learn in America and basically the West has accepted is the Zionist version, which says that this was a story of revival and heroism. After the United Nations passed the partition resolution, the Arabs attacked the Jewish community, wanting to kill them. And miraculously, because we're heroes, because we are the descendants of King David who defeated Goliath and so forth, we were able to defeat the Arabs once again, or, you know, some evil empire once again, and we prevailed, and now we have a state for the Jewish people in their historic homeland after 2,000 years. Again, it's like a chapter out of the Bible, like a chapter out of the Old Testament. It's so dramatic, and how do you even begin to argue with that? And then we have the Palestinian version, which talks about ethnic cleansing, terrorism, and a very cruel occupation. Now, go bridge those two stories. They're unbridgeable. And I think one of the realities we have to accept about this issue is that when you accept one narrative, you necessarily reject the other. They can't live together. And it's one of these issues, and I think the solution and the reality today is the same. You either, by accepting one narrative, you reject the other. There's no room here for them to live together. They're up, they are diametrically opposed. And this is something which is very difficult for some people to accept. They say about me in my talk that I'm divisive, and I'm saying it's not me that's divisive. The reality is such that if you take a stance, it's divisive, you know. But this is why it's divisive. We have two stories that emerged after this point in, at the end of 1947, 1948, that are diametrically opposed. And it really wasn't until Israeli historians began looking into this, like Ilan Pape and some of the others, and validating what the Palestinians have been saying, that people began to pay attention to the Palestinian narrative. Palestinians have been saying these things for decades, but we can't believe them. Ilan Pappas says it, you know, Jewish Israeli with German background, and now people are paying attention. So that's a sad reality of this. Now, I had another interesting experience, which was very personal, and I relate the story in my book, and that's a story that has to do with my mother. And my mother was born and raised in Jerusalem. She still lives there. She's going to be 90 this year. And a story that she told me many, many times as I was growing up has to do with an experience that she had in 1948. Now, living in Jerusalem as she was, as she did, at the, and she still does, she was living in a small apartment with her parents. And when the Israeli forces came in and took the Palestinian neighborhoods of Jerusalem, I'm talking about West Jerusalem, which became part of Israel, these beautiful Palestinian homes became available and were offered to Israeli families. So my mother was offered one of these homes. And by the way, these neighborhoods and these homes are still there. They're occupied by Israelis. But my mother decided, she said, no, she refused. She said, I'm not going to take the home of another family. How can I possibly move into the home of another mother? Now, at 22 and being already a mother, refusing a beautiful home for practically for free is not something that's easy to do. So we're all very proud and happy that she did that. And then when she told me the story, and again, she told me the story many, many times as I was growing up, she would continue the story by saying that after the Palestinians were forced out of their homes and these homes were taken, there was looting that was done by the Israeli soldiers. And she remembers seeing the trucks full of loot, full of furniture and rugs, and these well-to-do communities, well-to-do homes. And again, we're talking about the part of Jerusalem which became Israel, West Jerusalem. So it's a very interesting story, and it's a very good story. But for me, growing up, this story was a big problem. Because on the one hand, we had the narrative. And on the other hand, there's a very personal story of my mother. And the two contradict each other, you know. And I wasn't really able to understand why this story was a problem for me until I was working on the book. And I realized that there's a problem here because her personal story contradicts the national narrative. Now we go on and we hear that there actually wasn't really a Palestine. And if there was a Palestine and if there were Palestinians, then there weren't that many of them. And the ones that were there were poor farmers or Bedouins. And, you know, there was nothing there. So I like to show these pictures from the city of Jaffa. which is a city, you know, an Arab city on the coast of the Mediterranean. And it was a city of about 120,000 people with a rich business life and a social life and a cultural life. And a very famous theater called the Jamal Basha Theater was there. And the biggest names in the Arab world would come to perform. And several newspapers were published in Yaffa. And it was a thriving Arab city. And you can see the beautiful boulevards. And then in a matter of 2 weeks, in 1948, this big, beautiful city was brought down to about 4,000 people. And these 4,000 people were concentrated in one neighborhood with barbed wires and Israeli guards surrounding them. Now, this is an important story for several reasons. First of all, there was a Palestine, and this is one example of one city. Besides that, it shows us that Palestine is not and cannot be limited to just the West Bank and Gaza. And number three, this explains the refugee problem, because people talk about the Palestinian refugee problem as though it just came out of thin air. It's just there, the refugee problem. How did that happen? And where did these refugees come from? So I think this is an important story to tell. And again, Yaffa is just one example. Now, between 1948 and 1949, 1967, this is what the map looked like. Now, depending on where you stand on this issue, if you're a Palestinian and you understand and you're familiar with the Palestinian narrative, this is occupied Palestine. If you're an Israeli, or if you view it in an Israeli from the Israeli perspective, then this is the state of Israel prior to 1967, and perhaps one day, through some kind of mythical peace agreement with a two-state solution, this is what it's going to look like. And people still have this map from time to time, although in Israel this map doesn't exist. You're not going to see this in Israel anywhere. Not in school books, not in weather maps, not in any official documents. This does not. You don't see this delineation. But I think unless we come to terms with the fact that the occupation did not begin in 1967, the occupation of Palestine began in 1948, and that this represents occupied Palestine, the first 20 years of the occupied Palestine, where the majority of the land was taken by Israel, and settlers and settlements were built there, and settlers lived there. And although Israelis who live in Tel Aviv and some of these other places don't like to call themselves settlers, that's exactly what we are. And the land was stolen and the water was stolen and so forth. Unless we understand this, it's very hard to move forward. And this is a point where I still see people, even Palestinians will say, yeah, you know, the occupied Palestinian territories, and they refer to the West Bank and Gaza. And my question is, well, where are the Palestinian territories that are not occupied? Can somebody show them to me? And of course, there is no such thing, all of Palestine. And then what happened in 1967 again, the story that we hear is that Israel was under an existential threat, had no choice but to start the war, and then took the land, and it was spoils of war, and then maybe one day we'll have peace based on this map. Now, this is a picture of my father, you know, the general's son. This is the general while he's still in office, while he's still in uniform. And he made a name for himself as being, a fierce young officer in 1948 who, you know, fought and, you know, on the Israeli side, of course, and fought for the land and fought for the people, the Jewish people, and so on. And then in 1967, as part of the Israeli high command, who took the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and all the other territories that were taken in 1967. But he did something very interesting, because immediately after the war, he stood up, all state in uniform, and said, we now have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem, and what we need to do is to allow the Palestinians to establish a state in those two areas, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Which, by the way, those two areas, how did they become? Who created the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? Israel did. The reason that there is a West Bank and a Gaza Strip is because in 1948, Israel decided to keep those two areas out of the state of Israel. So they were delineated and defined by Israel. So that's what my father said immediately after the war. Of course, as he was saying this was the fifth or sixth day of the war. It was a six-day war. Israeli bulldozers were already destroying Palestinian towns and building Israeli settlements for Jews only in the West Bank, like they do everywhere else. And then he continued after he retired from the military to pursue this, And that was his legacy. The second half of his life, he dedicated to this idea of the two-state solution and Israeli-Palestinian peace. It's based on that. And that's really when the idea of the two-state solution was invented. That's, you know, him and several others, they were the first ones to talk about it. And at some point in the mid-70s, they were contacted, he and these other Israelis were contacted by members of the PLO who were interested in this. And in this picture, he's with Issam Sartawi, who was a Palestinian ambassador in Paris for many years. And the issue was to convince, particularly Yasser Arafat, but to convince basically the Palestinian leadership or the rest of the Palestinian leadership that they should recognize the State of Israel, drop the demand for the return of the refugees, drop the armed struggle, drop the resistance completely, and make peace with the State of Israel. And this was something that took many years. And Issam Sartawi was one of the Palestinians who led this within the PLO. What we know today, looking back, is eventually they did convince Yasser Arafat. Eventually he did accept the State of Israel and drop the resistance and the demand to free all of Palestine. And that led to the Oslo peace process. And again, looking back as what we know today, it was a catastrophic decision. The recognition of the State of Israel, the willingness to engage in peace talks with Israel, and the whole idea of the two-state solution and moving forward with that idea was catastrophic for the Palestinians. It was a big mistake. And much of the reason that the reality in Palestine for Palestinians is so severe today has to do with giving up the struggle to really free Palestine and the recognition of the State of Israel. But there's this tendency that any willingness on the part of any Israeli or any Jew to make the smallest concession or recognize in the smallest way the Palestinian suffering already hails, people start hailing them as peace heroes, as men of peace or women of peace. And, you know, this becomes the story. This particular general or that particular general spoke about peace. But they never renounce what they've done. And this is true for my father. I think my father was very sincere in his desire to bring about peace, and he really thought, and some of the people around him really thought, that the two-state solution was the only solution that was that had some chance. But the reality is they never looked back and said this entire thing was a crime. The entire ethnic cleansing of Palestine was a crime. And we need to somehow atone for that. That really never is something that never took place. So in summing up, and I think this is very important, what happened in 1967? In 1967, the occupation of Palestine did not begin. In 1967, Israel completed the occupation of Palestine, and the generals that were my father's comrades in arms all congratulated themselves for completing the job. They called it finishing the job. The occupation that began in 1948 was completed in 1967. It was not the beginning of something. It was the completion of the process, which is why they went right ahead and started building cities and towns for Jews only like they did in other parts of the country. They didn't see that there was any difference between the West Bank, what they call Judea and Samaria. Nobody says West Bank in Israel. It's Judea and Samaria or the Galilee or any other place. The second thing that happened, or as a result of that, is the finalizing of the single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people, what they call the Jewish state. And I think this is another crucial element. There is no possibility of a two-state. There is no possibility of a partition. There is a single state over all of Palestine. Israel established the single state. It's a single state for Jewish people or with exclusive rights for Jewish people. Now, the reason I take issue with the fact that they call it a Jewish state is because I don't know what's Jewish about it. The majority of the people who live there are not Jews. There's a Palestinian majority. Most Jewish people don't live there. Most Jewish people live in other places. And I've never even been there. There's nothing inherently Jewish about the State of Israel other than they use it, you know, the Star of David. But the regime that was established, as soon as the State of Israel was created, it was a regime of apartheid. Of course, they don't call it apartheid. They call it something else. But it was a regime of apartheid. The very first laws that were passed by the Knesset were laws that clearly defined Israel as a racist apartheid state. I mean, the mere definition of it as a Jewish state, where everybody knows that this is was taken from Arabs, and there was a big Arab-Palestinian population still there, is already racist. But we go on to the laws that relate to the land ownership and laws that relate to citizenship and so on. We know that the Israeli Water Authority, which controls all the water, allocates only 3% of the water to the Palestinian population. So the majority of the population is allocated only 3% of the water. So, I mean, this is beyond clear that from the very beginning it was defined and planned as a state that was an apartheid state. But again, unless we understand this, it's impossible to move forward. There is no way to redo or undo what was done. And we're taking the West Bank and settling it with Jews and building there for Jews only, that was exactly why it was taken. It wasn't a mistake. Now, basically what they were hoping to do, and they're still hoping to do, this is a process that's still going on today, you know, some 7 decades after Israel was established and almost 50 years since they completed the occupation, is to completely erase Palestine off the map. And indeed, in Israel, there is no Palestine. The map is like this. It says Israel. They talk about the Israeli cities and towns, whether it's in the West Bank or the Galilee or anywhere else, like it's all part of the same thing. And indeed, I think it is. They've created a reality where that is the way it is. And then we have the Gaza Strip. And again, this reality that exists there, this catastrophe that it exists there, that thankfully Bernie Sanders finally admitted to and alluded to and or talked about very clearly in the last debate, it's almost talked about again with there's never any context. How did this happen? How has it happened that we had hundreds of thousands of refugees ending up there? The Gaza Strip, like the West Bank, was defined by Israel. Now, as a result of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, they had to have a place to house all these refugees. So a line was drawn around the city of Gaza, and that is where they were pushed into. And refugee camps were built all through what was called this thing called the Gaza Strip. And if we look, I mean, I won't read through all the stats. And again, Bernie Sanders alluded to some of them. You know, 90% of the water is not safe for drinking. You know, a large part of the population are children. The majority of the population are children and so forth. Literacy rates are very, very high. And you look at the poverty rate and the unemployment and you look at the literacy rates and that doesn't make sense. Usually literacy rates means, you know, plenty of jobs and people are working and there's, you know, prosperity. Here we have high literacy rates and this disastrous reality. But of course it's imposed on them by Israel. And all of this is a result of the ethnic cleansing of 1948. If there was no ethnic cleansing of 1948, there would not have been refugees, there would not have been a Gaza Strip, there would not have been a Hamas, there would not have been any of this. But unless we connect the dots and go back to where this started, there's no context. We can never understand why we are where we are and how do we move ahead. And then we have the attacks on Gaza. Israel began attacking Gaza in the early 50s, pretty much as soon as the Gaza Strip was established. And these are pictures of Israeli commandos coming out of Gaza. Israel had several commando units. And the picture over there on the end is Ariel Sharon, young Ariel Sharon. You see the knife on his belt? And these are the Israeli commandos coming out of Gaza. This is in the early 50s after punitive operations. And the way they described it or the way they justified it is that there were infiltrators coming in from Gaza. And who are these infiltrators? You know, of course, we imagine all kinds of bloodthirsty Arabs coming to slaughter Jews. But mostly these were people who came to go back to their homes, to try to bring food. From time to time, they did come and commit acts of armed resistance. And then Israeli commandos would go in there and commit terrible acts of, well, massacres, really. This went on through the 50s, and then the 60s, and then the 70s. The names of the people in Gaza that justify the attacks changed. At first, they were infiltrators. Then they were fedayeen. Then they were just plain terrorists. Now they call them Hamas. The name of the devil there changes and evolves. And, of course, the weapons evolve as well. This is what it looks like. These are the weapons Israel uses today. So whereas in the beginning they would kill a few dozens or maybe a few hundreds, today, the last attack in 2014, Israel murdered over 20 or close to 2,500 innocent civilians in broad daylight, you know. So the ability to kill has grown. The weapons are more sophisticated. But still, the question that nobody asks is, you know, why? Why is Israel attacking Gaza so consistently, so heavily, knowing full well that there hasn't ever been, and there isn't today, any threat to Israel from Gaza? There's never been a tank in Gaza. There's never been a regular army in Gaza. People in Gaza have never had even the remotest ability to threaten Israel in any way. So why are they attacking them like this? Why did they go in with these enormous punitive operations? And I think the reason is that the existence of this humanitarian catastrophe, where nearly 2 million people live really, literally next door to Israeli cities and towns where people live like this. I mean, you wouldn't imagine an Israeli town where there's no clean water running in the tap, there's no electricity, there's no air conditioning when it's hot. I mean, that doesn't exist where there's not plenty of food and medicine when you need it. And this is across the street from this humanitarian catastrophe. Almost 2 million people living without water that's fit for drinking. Imagine a child that needs antibiotics and there's no antibiotics. I mean, it's that simple. Never mind the bombing and the thousands and thousands of injured that have no access to proper health care. And again, 10-minute drive from Gaza, you've got perfectly good Israeli hospitals that could treat people. But, of course, Palestinians in Gaza don't have access to that. This reality, when it sits right next to the reality in Israel, is a threat to the legitimacy of Israel. It's a threat to the narrative that illustrates Israel as a David that's fighting a Goliath. And so there are only two options. One option is to allow the people of Gaza, the refugees, to go back to their homes, to end the siege, to release the prisoners, to rebuild. But Israel doesn't want to do that. Doing nothing is not an option because people are going to ask questions. Why aren't you doing something about this? So they attack them and kill them and blame them for being terrorists, which works. And if we look as the years went by, Israel feels perfectly free to go and kill pretty much as many people as it wants in Gaza. And this excuse that they're terrorists works. In 2014, the excuse was self-defense. And how do you have to be, it's like a magic trick. You have to be a magician to convince people that dropping millions of tons of bombs on innocent civilians is somehow self-defense. But here in America, everybody talks about it. Self-defense, self-defense, self-defense. Self-defense against what exactly? And it's this image that threatens the legitimacy of the Zionist project of the entire state of Israel. And again, this is happening every single day as we sit here today. Now, the problem with this issue is that it's not only happening in Palestine, it's happening around the world, it's happening specifically here in the United States. And one example of the persecution of Palestinians and Muslims here in America is the prosecution of what's called the Hoyland Foundation, the Hoyland Foundation case, which is also the subject of a book I'm working on right now. And the story of the Hoyland Foundation case was the Hoyland Foundation was the largest Muslim charity organization in America. After 9/11, by an executive order, George Bush closed them down, saying that they were funneling money to Hamas, supporting a terrorist organization. According to their lawyers, and I spoke to their lawyers, this is what they said. The entire judicial system here in America was taken hostage. The Constitution, the laws, and government agency regulations were suspended. And as a result of pressure by Israel, the post-9/11 hysteria, and cowardice of the judiciary, and I'm quoting this, okay, we have a bunch of guys who did nothing wrong and were given completely insane prison sentences. Now, the three that you see here on the screen are three that I was able to visit in prison. And there are two others that I have not yet been able to visit. But this points to the fact, a very strange reality, the existence of a very strange reality, where the persecution of a people in their own land was imported here to America. And this is the Holy Agnes Foundation case is a very big case, and it was really a foundation of this reality. But there are other cases as well, and this is a case that I'm working on, so I know quite a bit about it. But this reality that the persecution of a people continues after they left the country from which they are kicked out, and they're trying to build a life in a new country in the new world, and their existence. And again, because their existence here and their work here as a charity trying to help Palestinians contradicts the narrative, contradicts the legitimacy of the state of Israel, they have to be persecuted and prosecuted if possible here in the United States. And the terrorism charges were complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. I saw the prosecution file. I read through the papers. It is complete and utter nonsense. And it's unbelievable the judges saw this stuff and allowed it to continue. And we have to talk about resistance. People don't like Hamas. Hamas is terrorism, so we don't like them because they're terrorists. And any form of, any expression of resistance by Palestinians is somehow equated with terrorism. The reality is, however, I think it was expressed best by Frantz Fanon, where he said, colonialism is not a machine capable of thinking. You cannot allow this colonialist project to go on and say, well, we're actually going to restrain it by allowing a two-state solution. You can't restrain it. The project of colonizing Palestine for the Jews meant colonizing all of Palestine for the Jews, and that's it. And you can't pull it back once you've set it in motion. It is naked violence and only gives in when confronted with greater violence. Now, we know today, thankfully, because we had the experience of India, and because the Black American experience here, and the experience of South Africa, and today, specifically over the last couple of few decades, the Palestinian experience, we know that violence is not the only way. The armed struggle is not the only way to defeat colonialism and to defeat injustice. There are other ways. So there's economic pressure, there's political isolation, all of which worked in these other cases, not in Palestine yet, though. And there's the BDS, which now is being... Now there's legislation to outlaw BDS and even outlaw talking and suggesting boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So if a principled, unarmed form of resistance is illegal and armed resistance is illegal, what is exactly the expectation? That over 6 million people living in Palestine under Israeli occupation, granted the different parts of the country, they live under different laws and a different bureaucracy that governs their lives, and they're not allowed to do anything. They have to sit and negotiate, and they have to be good boys and girls. And if they dare talk about boycott, if they dare talk about isolating Israel or kicking Israel out of FIFA or pressuring artists and so forth not to go and perform in Israel, or if they dare, God forbid, to use armed resistance, all of it is bad. All of it is terrorism. All of it is, you try to legislate against all of it. It's not realistic. It's absurd. It is absolutely absurd to think that there will be no resistance. And here in the United States, there's another aspect which has really contributed to the conversation here, to raising the level of a conversation here in America, and that's Students for Justice in Palestine. They do tremendous work on campuses, unbelievable work, and the courage of these young people, many of whom are Jews, by the way. Some are Palestinians, but many of them are Jews, including, like you heard earlier, my son. You know, they have managed to fight a very difficult fight against university administrations, against the millions and millions of dollars that are poured into this by Israel and Stand With Us and all these organizations. And this I see as definitely as part of the Palestinian resistance, and they're doing a very good job. So I think it's very important to recognize that this is what we need to support. You know, like I said earlier, do we use it peace talks or is it resistance? There's no question in my mind that as people who do care for peace and justice in Palestine need to support this resistance. The BDS movement, the Students for Justice in Palestine, and all other forms of Palestinian resistance, which are unarmed. Now, I was asked this earlier, and I get asked this all the time, is there any hope, or do I think there's any hope, or am I hopeful? And my question is this. There's no question in my mind that I am hopeful. I think we have to be hopeful. I think it's criminal to talk about this issue and not find hope. It's criminal because we're just sitting in the same place complaining all the time. It is up to us, who are rich, free, and alive all at the same time, as they say, to find hope and then act. Now, where does hope lay? Where is there hope? Is there hope in a reality that exists today where there's a state, a single state in Palestine, that offers exclusive rights to Jewish people? Or are we going to find hope in a single democracy, in a democratic state that respects human rights, that allows for equality and justice and freedom for everybody who lives within its boundaries? This is the big question. And it has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with values. If we accept that having a state that only gives rights to part of the population, then that's one set of values. If we believe that all people deserve equality and justice and freedom, that's a different set of values, and there's really very little to argue. Because you can't argue. These are your values, you know. And, of course, my what I would support is the second option. And I'm going to leave you here with this image. This is a picture that I took in a refugee camp, Palestinian refugee camp. And let me tell you something, if any of us were living in that camp, none of us would be smiling. I can promise you that. A week in that camp, none of us would be smiling. And I think it's important for us to kind of wrap our heads around, what does it mean when we say free Palestine? What does free Palestine mean? And I would argue that a free Palestine means all of Palestine. Not a little percentage here and a little percentage there, a little piece of land here and a little piece of land there. All of Palestine, the Galilee, and the Negev Desert, and Jerusalem, and Jaffa, and the West Bank, and every other place, and of course, Gaza. Free from occupation, free from walls, free from racist laws. And if we're talking about hope, I would say that there's no question in my mind that Palestine must be free, and Palestine can be free, and if we do our job, then Palestine will be free, and much sooner than most people think. Thank you very much.
That was Miko Peled speaking at the Church Center for the United Nations in New York City. And that is our program this morning. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Bob was on his way to work just after dropping the two boys off at a private high school, I believe, in Nairobi. He was on the way to the embassy. And he was broadsided at a stoplight at 60 miles an hour by a reinforced Land Rover. He was killed instantly. The Brit that supposedly was drunk at 7 in the morning was taken to the hospital and immediately disappears. And all the evidence he had given in the way of documentation was proven to be phony as to who he was. And Bob was killed. And it was a hit. And it's always concerned me today that he had gotten a little too close to who had been involved with Siemens implantable chip technology. We'd been trying to, for a couple of years then, quietly trying to find out who had been doing it without our government realizing it was going on. Because whoever it is has got total ability to penetrate anytime, anywhere, our government instantly.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. State-sponsored child sexual abuse. The course of justice is perverted at the VI paedophile inquiry, but will heads roll? Thank you. Whatever happened to Lowell Goddard, the third chair of the VIP to file inquiry, went back home to New Zealand last month, and just as she was about to appear at the Home Affairs Select Committee, Keith Vaz was sacked. No doubt she left after having signed a confidentiality agreement, so survivors of sexual abuse are left wondering why. And leaks suggest it's because she wasn't happy with her staff. Well, the inquiry's number one lawyer, Ben Emerson, has been suspended and now has resigned as well. The new chair, Alexis Jay, is not saying anything about it. So why was the head of the inquiry forced to employ Home Office staff who were themselves under suspicion over the child sex abuse cover-up? Is this all part of a government and civil service attempt to derail the inquiry, which could expose leading figures in government, civil service, children's charities like the NSPCC even, the church, the BBC and even royalty to prosecution? Also, today's funeral of Shimon Peres, the Israeli Prime Minister. We remember this show's fleeting encounter with him. Wanting access all areas to the in the run-up to the 2012 London Olympics, and access after the ousting of G4S that he was denied. Also, a commander of the al-Nusra Front in Syria, now known as the Sham Liberation Front, he admits to being supported by the Pentagon. So why haven't we been told that on the news? Finally, we break the taboo of religion and politics. Which god do many rich and powerful people worship, if any? Our sister show Dialect is back at noon every Tuesday now. This week, author of Swallow This, The Dark Secrets of the Food Industry, with author Joanna Blythman. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. First, I'm joined on the line by child sex abuse survivor Sam Hill. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Hi.
First of all, what's your reaction to the news this week that that Ben Emerson, the leading lawyer in the inquiry, has first of all suspended and then he's decided to resign?
Well, there's not much transparency regarding what really is going on, but I've spoken to a few survivors, Esther Baker, and a few people I know, and they're quite glad to see him go. They didn't think he was really good for the job.
But he's been there for the last 2 years doing this, and we've seen a whole succession of various chairs of this inquiry disappearing, really, as they're appointed. We've had, first of all, Baroness Butler Schloss and Fiona Wolfe, both of who were connected to Leon Britton and the era where Leon Britton, former Home Secretary, was supposed to have covered this up back in the 1980s. And then there was Lowell Goddard. She was removed as well. She's now back in New Zealand, but nobody's really quite sure why she left. And now we've got this person, Alexis Jay. Yeah. So, I mean, I said at the top of the hour just there about whether there's you think this is being derailed deliberately. Do you think there's any chance that this will succeed, this inquiry?
Well, eventually the people keep dropping out. One or two of the bad ones will go and perhaps, you know, something more will develop, something better. Because, you know, maybe he was the problem and maybe we'll actually have somebody who will stick with the job now.
Well, what's your own thoughts about this whole thing, which was floated really at the time that Alexis Jay, was appointed and Lowell Goddard left, which is the idea of employing a whole load of civil servants from the Home Office in this job?
No, that doesn't seem very satisfactory, does it? Because these institutions themselves are going to be under the spotlight and, you know, there'll be, you know, massive claims of people wanting to get insurance. So they're going to want to safeguard that, aren't they? They're working for them.
Now, one of the main things that the Home Office does, of course, is it oversees the police and it does things like administers cuts to the police at the moment. And so the police, what's your thoughts about the way the police have dealt with these claims over the last 40, 50 years even?
Well, I think they're very status orientated and they're very much sort of tipping their hat to people who, you know, they fear good sort of condemning or bringing to justice, and they've been told not to bring them to justice, haven't they? So it's very easy for them then to sort of scoop up the remains of, you know, whoever comes to them and divert them very often away from justice. So I think it's reputation management a lot of the time within the institutions. On one side, they want to uphold the reputations of the powerful. On the other side, if someone's been vulnerable in care or any other system, mental health system or anything, they can use that to stigmatise and steer them away from justice. And they can actually, you know, manipulate the records rather than dealing with huge amounts of paperwork, which they'll be dealing with now in the inquiry, regarding all the things that they've covered up. If they can steer people away, as they did in Rotherham, by saying, we don't want to handle these people, they're the wrong sort of people making these accusations, they will do that, and they have been doing that.
There's another side to this, of course, and if someone is appointed to run the inquiry, one would have thought it was taken as read that they could decide who to employ as their staff and who they trusted, because these staff are going to be dealing with a massive amount of confidential paperwork, etc. And if the person running the inquiry doesn't trust their own staff, that might be a problem almost from the word go.
Yes, it would be a huge problem, yes. I don't know how it could be resolved.
And what's your own experience been with the police? Who, let's just remind listeners, I mean, the Home Office is intimately connected with the police, over the years. If you could just tell us what your dealings, times you've been to the police and how you've been dealt with.
They were very dismissive because of the people I was made accusations towards. They were dismissive because of their status and the fact my status had been set quite early on in life. I'd suffered emotionally and sort of been vulnerable, and they looked upon that as some sort of reason not to bother, really.
Now, I know you were initially sexually abused when you were around about 11, 12 years old. When did you first decide to actually talk to the police about all this?
I wanted to talk to the police at one point when I was 16, but that's when everyone closed ranks against me, and I was steered towards mental health as if I was, you know, something wrong with me.
So let's just get this clear. You were threatening to talk to the police about the abuse, and then your abusers kind of managed to get you sectioned, is that right?
Well, yes, and my family closed ranks, and they all moved house. Nobody was prepared to deal with it. I was always the problem. I was seen as the problem. But unfortunately, what happens then is the state will continue seeing you as the problem very often, because what they have written about you, what they have decided about you, carries on. You can't go back and say, you know, I am not, you know, what you've written on your record about me is not true. They write these records about people. And it's used, you know, in a way to sort of defer you away from any form of civil justice.
Now, I suppose one of the main backstops when any kind of sexual abuse happens is the parents. Just tell us a little bit about what happened with your own parents when you spoke to them.
They were very young. They weren't keen to discuss any of it. I was always told to move on with my life, forget it, turn around, don't walk back, don't look back, sort of thing, which really isn't possible, because sooner or later it will rear up again and the memories will return.
But aren't you tempted to do that now, to just say, look, I've had enough of this?
To gain some sort of justice, you mean?
Well, no, I mean to just say, look, I mean, it's a really terrible trial to go through at the time, this abuse. But then to have almost every time that you are trying to get something done about it, it's almost like a kind of another form of abuse.
It is. The records that they make on you, once you are known to the authorities, you may not have done anything wrong, but, you know, you may have had mental health problems. You may even just be vulnerable. You may have been homeless. You know, your status is always sort of questioned. And these people that I, you know, who were involved in the abuse, their status would never be questioned because they were completely above being questioned.
Now, I know you were in a situation at one time where you were actually forced really back with your abuser because you were homeless. Tell us how that happened.
I was forced. Oh yes, indeed. He and I were living together. I was controlled by him into my mid-20s. Sadly enough, but I mean, he had used the authorities against me, my mental health history. I had a breakdown at 19 and managed to pull all sorts of strings. And I tried to run away from him, went to stay in a hotel in my hometown. And they said to him, oh, you know, she's gone. Do you want us to call the police and bring her back? And eventually I was. They caught up with me on the motorway and brought me back to him. So I couldn't escape.
Well, that sounds pretty horrific.
Yeah.
But what about your more recent contacts with the police? Because I know after the Jimmy Savile scandal, I mean, this sort of rears its head, it seems, every few years or so. What was your latest experience of the police? Just take us through that.
Yes. I approached them about 7 or 8 months ago in reasonably good faith, because I thought times have changed. And I'd managed to build up my self-esteem, being around a very nice group of people, helping, making positive progress with the CSA campaigning, only to be brought back to square one again, to where I was all those times before when I'd made complaints and tried to go to the police. I was waiting for 6 months. They had hardly any contact with me until I spoke to Esther Baker, who told me, "Oh, well, you know, you should be getting updates every month." Oh, well, that's not been happening. There's something wrong here. I'd been talking to Exaro, and they said, "Well, look, should we ring them on your behalf, find out what's happening?" I was just told just to sort of wait because I didn't want to seem like I was pushing them. So eventually I contacted them. It was almost 6 months after my first police interview, and they said, "Oh well, it's been dropped. It was dropped 4 weeks ago," and no one had told me. There wasn't somebody extra working on the case as they'd told me there would be. There was actually somebody reviewing me, going over all my medical notes, and just dismissing my evidence, not interviewing anybody, and no one had told me.
So what's your experience to be almost like treated as the perpetrator rather than the victim again?
Yeah. Well, you just get stigmatised by the state, and it's very useful. I think abusers probably realise this in a way, that they have the advantage, they have more power in society, and you're going to spend a lot of years, you know, recovering. So, you know, if you can't break away from them, a family who are complicit and people like that, then you're going to be held down, you know, basically, and the state will carry on that as well.
Now, I noticed earlier on 5 Live on the BBC, lots of suggestions that this inquiry should be shut down. What do you think?
No, I don't think it should. I think we've got to keep going. I think we really need to keep going, and there really need to be some legal changes made, like reporting, mandatory reporting, and the Official Secrets Act not being used to protect powerful paedophiles. So many changes need to be made. We haven't had really any progress. We need something. Otherwise, people are going to get very, very disheartened.
Now, Martin Summers, I'll just bring you in here, because Sir Peter Hayman, who was the deputy head of MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Service, he was one of the people who was implicated in this paedophilia, but many of these people have died. And is it actually impossible for the state to investigate itself?
Well, it shouldn't be. I mean, in theory, the police are supposedly independent of the intelligence services, although often they're not. And, you know, my suspicion is that the intelligence services have used abuse as a tool to blackmail various people at the top of society to make sure that they do what they're supposed to be, you know, do as they're told. And that this is really underlying all of this, that you've got the general power imbalance, which has been mentioned. Which is obviously, you know, a big issue with in this kind of case, but I think also the state itself has used child abuse as a tool. So Kincorra Boys Home in Northern Ireland, it's a big issue over there. MI5 were using it as a place to you know, blackmail targets who were they would be filmed having sex with underage boys and then blackmailed subsequently. And I think that this is the reason why the state's so paranoid about all this coming out, because it's sort of it shows the dark side of what they do.
Well, I would use the word afraid, not paranoid. I mean, they've got every right to be afraid, because you're talking about effectively a criminal cover-up. What's your take on this whole idea of using Home Office staff to run this inquiry?
Well, what it looks at like from the outside is that they're using this kind of investigation and inquiry in order to try and basically cover their backsides. That's what British inquiries generally do, and I don't think we should give up on inquiries, but on the other hand, you've got to recognise that the strategy of inquiry from the point of view of the state is to make this stuff go away, or at least put it on the back burner. It's not to get to the bottom of it, but it's up to everybody else to make sure that the inquiry doesn't do that.
Also, how far high up do you think this goes? Because, I mean, I mentioned the royal family, but, you know, Jimmy Savile was very friendly with them. They were also involved in the cover-up in Jersey, in making sure that the abusers, both sexual and abusers in the mental health, that is, putting people who are mentally ill in solitary confinement for long periods of time, that they were allowed to keep their jobs.
Well, if, as I suspect, that child abuse is not just a random thing, but has actually been used as a tool by the intelligence services to blackmail various top politicians and others, then that will be the bottom line. They don't want it to come out, because they will have gone out of their way to encourage this kind of behaviour, so that those engaged in the behaviour can be subsequently blacked.
Now, in a couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at the anniversary of the Dutroux scandal in Belgium. So it's not just Britain. It may even be that this is going on in many countries, and Britain is just the only country that's grappling with it, trying to deal with it.
I'm afraid the idea of using sex with underage people as a means of blackmailing, is definitely, it's just one of the tools of the trade of the secret services, whether British or anybody else. And I'm afraid that's probably what we're going to find if we get to the bottom of this. Although whether we will ever get to the bottom of it is another matter, because, of course, there's a lot of vested interest to prevent that from happening.
Bit by bit, of course, though, the information is trickling out about who's just talking the talk and who's actually walking the walk as part of this child sex abuse inquiry. Sam, can I ask you what your thoughts are about what should happen next, and whether you think that that Alexis Jay, who's in charge of this inquiry now, after Lowell Goddard, it looks as if was bullied out, whether she's the right person for the job?
I think we've just got to give her time, and something has to start happening, really. Then we can judge whether it's working or not.
What about the way that Lowell Goddard was removed? Have you followed any of that? Because I certainly saw that there were rumours that effectively she was elbowed out because she was not happy with Ben Emmerson, who's now, of course, gone.
Yes, well, that's interesting. Will we ever know? It's all shrouded in secrecy. And, you know, she said she missed her family. Would she have ever really taken the job in the first place if she was going to miss her family?
And we were about to find out what it was all about at the Home Affairs Select Committee, when suddenly Keith Vaz is caught in some kind of sting operation, the chair of that committee, and disappears off the face. Well, he certainly wasn't a chair of the committee anymore. What if you were in the Home Secretary's position, Amber Rudd, at the moment, what would you be up to, Sam?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think I would be listening to survivors. I think we're the ones with the knowledge, and we have really been stigmatised, and it's just, you know, it's sort of endemic of what we've experienced throughout, and we need to be listened to. We're not this, you know, these emotional people who are going to get it wrong. We would actually get it right. We want to point people in the right direction to regards what happened and what went wrong.
And in your own case, can you just explain to us the way you understand that the establishment was able to protect your abusers rather than to prosecute them?
I think it's sort of just the workload, that they fear the workload of actually, you know, dealing with things. It makes it much easier just to keep the status quo. If someone's vulnerable, we'll keep them in that position. We won't rock the boat by sort of giving them their full rights and encouraging them to take action and helping them find proof, etc. They just keep the status quo, and they follow the orders and the instructions they get from higher up. And basically, you know, it's they process people and stigmatise people frequently. But I don't know how it can really be changed, but it's the whole ethos of our institutions really needs a bit of a looking at.
Well, I think you're to be commended for carrying on the fight. And I think there has been a sea change in understanding that this is the sort of thing that goes on. I mean, a few years ago, if you'd said that senior people in this country were involved in child sex abuse, it wouldn't have rung true to many people. But of course, with all the revelations about Jimmy Savile and so on, people are now more aware of the issues. It's one step forward, two steps back, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've got to carry on, because future generations require this to be sorted out so that it's put a stop to.
Sam, I know you're on Twitter. How can people follow your stuff? And I know you've also written a book too.
Yes, I'm Sam Hill 12 12 12 on Twitter, and I've written a book called An Oath to Hell, which was my oath being thrown to hell by all the institutions and never being able to go to court, and, you know, and the Hippocratic Oath being broken. So it's really quite a prominent book. It describes the institutions and my dealings with them, really.
And what's your thoughts about what the best next steps are in the national inquiry?
Well, we need to start taking evidence and making a bit of progress. Nothing really has been done, has it? I think it just needs to really sort of get into the right mood for moving forward. And, you know, maybe when it gathers pace, people will be more inclined to have a bit of faith in it.
Well, one good thing is that this business with Ben Emerson and with Lowell Goddard and various other people involved in the inquiry who have been removed from it does seem to be sorting the sheep from the goats, if I can put it like that. That is the people who are sincerely interested in the interests of the survivors and those who are kind of there going through the motions. So, anyway, that's at least one thing positive, even though it's another problem, is that people are slowly learning who it is who's serious about making this inquiry work and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sam Hill, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show. Now, Martin, can you just sum up your thoughts about what you think the prospects are for this inquiry succeeding or not at the moment? I was actually really annoyed to hear the national media talking about saying that this inquiry should be finished and maybe that's it. It's just never going to work and everyone should just forget about it. That's what they were saying on the BBC earlier on today, suggesting anyway.
Well, at one stage there was a suggestion that the inquiry should not include Northern Ireland and should not include Kincorra Boys' Home, and the suggestion was that that shouldn't be included because Ireland wasn't part of the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom, which, if you think about it, is a rather strange argument for the British to make, since it basically accepts the Republicans' allegation that, the Republicans demand that the six counties shouldn't be part of the UK. But anyway, they have included it, and I think there is evidence to suggest that there's a pattern involved in all of this, especially at the highest levels. And I think if you think about it, the culture of the British intelligence services, particularly MI5, MI6, tended to be a gay culture, for example. At one stage, a lot of gay men were working there. And, of course, for many, many years, gay sex was illegal in this country. So there were a kind of... Because gay sex was illegal and many of MI5, MI6 officers were gay, they generally just started to disregard that kind of aspect of the law. But at what point does having sex with underage, you know, and the age of consent was 21, and so people will be having sex with people under 21 and thinking, well, that's all right, there's nothing the matter with that. But how low, you know, the whole culture of permissiveness around that allowed this kind of culture to develop. And then, of course, you've got the use of sex, illicit sex, as a means of blackmail. And that's pretty much what appears to have been happening at the Kincorra Boys Home. Now, we know about the Kincorra Boys Home, that there's also suggestions that children's homes in North Wales and other parts of the country, if you were a secret service that wanted to use children as sex objects to blackmail politicians and others, then you would go to children's homes.
Because Martin, the survivors group at Shirley Oaks, which has been very vocal recently, which is in South London, they have been saying effectively when the people that they were going to report sexual abuse in care were themselves paedophiles.
Well, that's right. So what you've got is a whole... they've got a distinction. A paedophile subculture within things like care homes, which is... And you know, wherever people... You know, paedophiles, we know, are quite devious at getting access to young people. But, of course, the VIP paedophiles, what we're talking about here, Andy Heyman, he was second in command of MI6... And he was found, some stuff was found on a bus, you know, photographs. He'd left them on the bus. The police went round to him and said, well, what's all this about? But he was let off. And I think that the culture of paedophilia is ingrained in the intelligence services.
I mean, it would be okay, wouldn't it, if it was just, say, one institution, but it seems as if it's systematic, where you've got social services, police all covering up and nobody able to...
If you're going to have a systematic programme of encouraging child abuse for political reasons, then you're going to have a pretty substantial cover-up operation ready to go. And don't forget, we're talking about people who are, you know, trained intelligence officers who know how to cover their tracks and know how to pull the right strings to get the results they want.
Okay, before we leave the subject, let's just have a listen, because there's no promises questions during the conference season, but this was put a couple of weeks ago and about the end of Lowell Goddard chairing the Child Sex Abuse Inquiry by Lisa Nandy.
Lisa Nandy.
It's been 2 years since the Prime Minister set up the Child Abuse Inquiry. It's onto its fourth chair, and last week the outgoing chair said that it had become inherently unmanageable. Since the Prime Minister appointed Dame Lowell Goddard to her position, will she insist that she comes before this House to explain herself? Yeah. Surely child abuse survivors deserve an explanation.
Well, first of all, on the process point that she's raised with me, of course, it's not for the Prime Minister to insist who attends before a committee of this House. I understand Dame Lowell Goddard has been invited to attend the committee. But what I would say on the child abuse issue is I think she and I share across this House, many honourable members, a desire to see these issues of these appalling crimes of child abuse being properly looked into. It's important that the inquiry, Dame Lowell Goddard has set up the inquiry, the Truth Project, many aspects of this which are already in place and operating. And I'm very pleased that Alexis Jay has taken on the role as chairman of the inquiry. She chaired the Rotherham work. I think she will do this work extremely well, and we will have answers to questions that so many have been asking for too long.
Well, one thing that the Prime Minister didn't say there was that Alexis Jay didn't actually recommend any kind of disciplinary action on any of the social workers or police that allowed this abuse to go on in Rotherham for something like nearly 15 years with thousands of offences, which many of which, of course, were reported to the police but without any action.
Well, in other words, the suggestion is that the British are trying to cover things up by using their inquiry system and all the rest of it. Well, that's goes without saying. We could say, well, let's not have an inquiry at all because it's going to be a cover-up. We've got to work with what we've got and keep banging away at it.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen because there are some people who are pretty determined to make sure this inquiry does work and that anybody that's trying to obstruct it is removed from the actual organisation of that inquiry. So we'll see what happens in future weeks.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin mentioned at the top of the hour that we've had reports that one of the commanders of the UNNASRA front in Syria has actually admitted to, quite happily, to a German reporter, I think it was, to being supplied by the Pentagon.
Yeah, well, he is actually the commander of al-Nusra inside Aleppo, which is where we're all supposed to be crying crocodile tears for the terrible things that the Russians and Syrian army are doing there. But he was interviewed by a German journalist, and it's been in the mainstream media in Germany have reported this. And he's asked a straight question, are you being supported by the Americans? He's saying, yes, we are, indirectly, but we want more support, please. And, you know, thanks very much for the anti-aircraft missiles, but we need some more stuff from you, blah, blah, blah. This is Al-Qaeda. That's what we're talking about, who are openly saying that they're in alliance with the Western intelligence services.
Right, it's the Kölner, if I try and pronounce it right, Kölner Stadtanzeiger, which is the Cologne main newspaper there, that's done this interview, and they've done it with Abu Al-Ez. He reported quite openly about his financiers being Saudi Arabian, Qatari and Kuwaitis.
Yeah. So, in other words, there's a cutout here. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Turkey are the direct suppliers of weaponry to al-Nusra inside Aleppo. But, of course, underlying all of that is the support from British, US and British intelligence services. And, I mean, the dogs in the street in the Middle East know that the CIA and MI6 support al-Qaeda, and they have done for years. Meanwhile, in this country, you talk to people, oh, yes, we're fighting these Muslim extremists all over the world, aren't we? Except we're not. We're arming them.
Abu Al-Az, he says about Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Nusra Front, he says, we are one part of al-Qaeda. He's quite open about being part of al-Qaeda. He says, our principles are fighting vice, pureness and security. I'm not sure if he's fighting pureness. I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense, that, but maybe it's missed in the translation. He said, our affairs and our way have changed. Israel, for example, is now supporting us because Israel is also at war with Syria and with Hezbollah.
Yes, in other words, he's letting a few cats out of the bag there. I mean, there was a suggestion last week, if you remember, that the Russians had sent missiles in to knock out an operations room in northern Syria, which was stuffed with Israeli, US, Qatari, Turkish British intelligence officers. Now, we've not heard anything about that. It was reported by the Iranians, so we've only got one source for that. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is the evidence shows, both in Libya and Syria and Afghanistan and elsewhere, that the Western intelligence services have an intimate relationship with al-Qaeda. So even if al-Qaeda did carry out the 9/11 attacks, which is very disputable, then it would be as part of an alliance with Western intelligence services, which has been going on for years, and in Syria is absolutely staring everybody in the face. Nevertheless, you've still got idiots in the British Parliament who seem to think that we're somehow at war with Islamic extremism while our special forces are training them out to shoot down aeroplanes.
Well, before we go back to talking about Syria, you mentioned 9/11 there, Martin. Of course, this is at the root of a lot of this, this whole idea that America can go around the world attacking anybody because of the 9/11 attacks. And a couple of months ago, I spoke to a guy who works with kids called Des K, and he's put together what I thought was quite a nice little children's poem about 9/11. So I thought we'd have a listen to that.
A little poem that I put together by Des K, The Grand Illusion. The whole world changed, or so they say, when 9/11 came our way. It came as a jolt from humankind, but of the cause, we seem completely blind. It changed the history of our world, but don't believe all you've been told. It's a story that you just can't buy. Some amateur pilots in the sky? Do you think those planes are so easy to steer? It's all designed to increase our fear. The quick collapse of each twin tower? Airline fuel doesn't have that power. Watch the film, it's there for all. Building 7 straight down in free fall. Could a building fall with one small blaze? You tell that to the people and their eyes start to glaze. The truth is there for all to see. Incendiary dust, a significant key. We seem to have become the collective fool. Fire-wrecked towers don't collapse as a rule. Why, none have fallen before that time. Burning infernos, but the steel stays fine. The newsreel gives us this hint, the buildings fall in their own footprint. And the plane that hit the Pentagon, a commercial airline, just seems wrong. Lots of fire and many sparks, 8-ton engines that leave no marks. We must wake up and smell the thermite if we want to make our future bright. Apprehend the ones who lied, we owe it to all those who died. We need a new Woodward and Bernstein to rock the boat, the internet is the new deep throat. The world is ruled by a very small crowd, although they work in silence. Their influence is loud. It won't be long before they lose their crown. It's their world that's falling down. Can't fall all of the time. The truth is clear. Look online. Close to getting the riddle solved. If you want to see justice, get involved. Do you want a world that's run by crooks, spying on our lives through the nooks, who treat us like we're disposable toys, playing with victims like excitable little boys? Get angry, get angry, get angry. Then stop. Take a deep, deep breath. Don't pick up a rock. See what it is that is making the change. Turning around is within our range. The internet for collective voice, making revolutions through a common choice and creating a difference on the ground. A common purpose is being found, working for the cause of all humanity. Finding the truth will set us free.
So great Des K there with his poem. I'd like, it'd be nice to hear that in the schools around, primary schools around Bristol. But anyway, Martin, he works, he does something called what he calls SaveTheWorldClub.org. But in fact, this stuff is very simple. In many parts of the world, this is taken as read, isn't it?
It is. I mean, for example, General Ivashov was a commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11. People can check him online. He's very calmly, very quietly said all along, well, we don't believe a word you're saying here. We think you did it. And, of course, if the head of the Russian armed forces says that, they will be making, and they will have reasons for saying that, which it's pretty obvious just by watching what happened that there's something not right about it. But no doubt the KGB or the FSB will have their ways of finding out what's been going on, and they know. And they've been basically trying to deal with an out-of-control US government ever since. And that's not to say that there haven't been similar incidents inside the Russian Federation, because that's the real world we live in, where basically terrorists are embedded within the intelligence infrastructure.
One of the lines Des has got in that poem is, their world is falling down. Well, it's good timing, isn't it? Because with Deutsche Bank on the brink. I mean, what would happen if Deutsche Bank did collapse this weekend?
Well, what would happen, quite possibly, is you're going to get a global crash on Monday morning. That's what will happen. I mean, when it happens, it will happen. And then there will, and of course, at that point, I suspect that the people behind all of this will have their plan to try and drag us to war or whatever, to try and cover up their failure to manage the economy properly. And, you know, wars are revolutionary things. They really are. And, you know, they're playing with fire.
But it could be the other way around, couldn't it? It could be that a war breaks out and then the crash is blamed on that. I mean, they tried to blame, potentially, saying Brexit could cause a crash. But actually, that's not quite true, is it? A war or Brexit? The crash is there
If you look at when the First World War broke out, there was immediately a crash and the stock markets around the world were closed. And then the governments had to adopt methods to run the economy without the stock market. So one of the things they did in Britain, for example, is they made the Bradbury pounds, which were basically issued by the government rather than by the Bank of England, which was still private at that stage, and they started to fund the war effort with money that the government had printed itself rather than from sourced in the banking system. That changed later in the war. But the thing about wars is it then forces the issue of how you're going to manage the economy when the private sector has collapsed. But of course, I suspect what will happen. It'll be the crash and the war will be simultaneous, and as it was in the beginning of World War One, where the run up to World War Two, you had the crash, then an interval, then the war. But in World War One, it was simultaneous, and I think World War Three will be simultaneous.
We did a programme, didn't we, a few years ago about what it would look like on a Friday night if the banks did crash, because this is when it happens. The stock markets crash or close, etc. So I'll put a link to that old show on our show page tonight, which is thisweek.org.uk. But in a nutshell, Martin, what does happen over the next few days?
Well, I imagine that what will happen is that the Germans will agree to bail out Deutsche Bank. And hopefully they will then hope that will stop the rot, but it then puts the German government in a difficult position because they'll have to allow others to do similar things for their own banking systems. So that will then create a political row within the European Union about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable policy. That would be a positive outcome. A negative outcome would be that the fact is that nobody manages to deal with the consequences of the collapse, and it just, I mean, Deutsche Bank is so big that it'll pull everything else down with it.
Okay, so as I said, we're going back to Syria now, and this is because I hadn't ever heard hardly any Syrian government officials speaking on the news over here, and I think we're at a very important time in Syria with the breakdown of this ceasefire and the apparent about to finally liberate Aleppo from these various terrorist groups. So I thought we'd have a listen to the Syrian ambassador to the UN, Bashar al-Jafari, and here he is talking in the street in New York this week to Caleb Maupin, who was over at the United Nations.
Our main message is that we are fed up, enough is enough. We need a genuine partners from the whole world combating terrorists. Some people are hypocrites because they pretend on one hand fighting the terrorists, but on the other hand they are backing them on one hand. I mean, this is number one. Number two, the same people are saying that their main enemy is President Assad, not Daesh, not ISIL. Then you cannot combat ISIL when you say that, because you are hypocrites. You are not addressing the main issue. Third point, you have nothing to do with who should rule over Syria. The Syrian people should decide who should rule over them. The Syrian people will not decide who should be the successor of Obama in the United States. So we are the ones who will decide. This is democracy. If they believe in democracy, this is democracy. The fourth point is that we have 101 member states out of 193 member states in the United Nations exporting to us their own terrorist garbage. These terrorist garbage are not opposition. They are mercenaries and foreigners. They are coming to kill our own people. with the Saudi money, the Turkish training, the American backing, the Qatari money, etc., etc. So enough is enough. The mask has fallen and we are fed up. No justification to anybody while we are accusing us of doing anything wrong. We are not doing anything wrong. We are defending our country by all the means, legal means.
I mean, what he's effectively saying is that there are lots of groups that are interfering in Syria from outside.
That's pretty obvious. It's been obvious all along. Many of the rebels inside Aleppo, including this al-Nusra Front chap we were mentioning earlier, are not in fact Syrians.
You heard the statement from this general who said about basically that a no-fly zone would require going to war with Syria and Russia. I mean,
this is blah, blah, blah. This is nonsense. It will not fly. They know, the generals, they know that it will not fly. The Americans, diplomats as well as military, are trying to justify their wrongdoings and their zone by saying, you know what, we made a mistake in bombing your soldiers in their zone, but the Russians also made a mistake in bombing the humanitarian convoy. So they are trying to create a parallel between their own big mistake when they bombed the Syrian military position by pretending that the Russians did the same, on the other hand, bombing the humanitarian convoy, which is not true, by the way, which is not true, yeah. Because there are no holes on the ground. The convoys were not bombed. There are no holes on the ground. And we are doing our own national investigation to know who did it. And we will share it with the UN. But again and again and again, the American administration is not genuine. It's not a genuine broker. And they don't have the will to respect the terms of reference of their own agreement with the Russians. Washington was not even able to respect the terms of reference for 7 days. 7 days of cessation of hostilities, they couldn't hold it because they don't have the political will. They are pretending that, you know what, we cannot separate the terrorists of al-Nusra Front from the other so-called moderate opposition. This is ridiculous. If you cannot separate these terrorists from those terrorists, then don't pretend that you want to make a cessation of hostilities decision for 7 days.
That was Bashar al-Jafari, and he was speaking in the street, as you might have saw about the sound quality there, in New York, to Caleb Maupin, Martin.
I think it's fairly clear that what happened was that, for whatever reason, Kerry was negotiating with Lavrov about this ceasefire, and the attack on the Syrian army position at Des Azur was a deliberate ploy by Ash Carter at the Pentagon to sabotage the peace plan being cooked up by Kerry and Obama. So Obama is a lame duck president. He's got some instincts of the right kind, but he's surrounded by maniacs who are determined to have a full-on war with Syria and Russia. And I'm afraid at this stage of the game, I would advise the Syrians and the Russians to stop talking and finish off fighting. And if, for example, the RAF send their planes over the border into Syria, just shoot them down. Shoot them straight away.
Why?
Because they shouldn't be there. They've got no legal basis to be there. And if they come over the border, especially after the killing of six... See, it was a very significant killing, those soldiers, because they were holding high ground, which allowed the airport to continue to function, which allows them to carry the whole city to be protected from ISIS.
So you're suggesting it wasn't a mistake?
No, it wasn't a mistake. Absolutely not. The Syrians and the Russians have said we don't think it was a mistake. Now, if it's not a mistake, that's a fairly clear signal by Dunford, who's the head of the Pentagon, and Ash Carter, who's head of defence. And they basically said afterwards, don't presume that we wouldn't do that again. Now, the fact is that that's a fairly clear signal. They're not on board with Obama's policy of ceasefire. The ceasefire's over. Now let's finish the war. Because, of course, the reason why they're making such a fuss about Aleppo is if Aleppo can be captured, then the war is virtually over and NATO lost. So that's what they can't accept.
Well, you mentioned briefly the involvement of Israel in the Syria conflict there, effectively on the same side as al-Nusra. Martin, Shimon Peres' funeral today, all the great statesmen, supposed great statesmen of the world, going over to his funeral.
Well, the Israelis have been involved in the Yinon plan, was put forward in the 1980s, which was to balkanize and create civil conflicts in all of Israel's neighbours to allow Israel to dominate the region.
Well, when you say Balkanize, I mean, you were over there in the original Balkans. Yeah. What does it mean?
Well, it's a phrase that just means breaking up existing states into smaller bits, which are much weaker than the larger states, and therefore, you know, Syria has been a consistent opponent of Israeli policy since 1948. And, of course, all the chaos within Syria now and the problems they're having created by NATO and the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Israelis mean that they are much less of a problem for the Israelis to worry about. Nevertheless, I mean, we've got reports from the Syrians that the Israelis have actually got operations rooms inside Syria working with British and other intelligence officers. And coming back to the Aleppo attack, I mean, the White Helmets were the ones who put the photographs out that showed these trucks that had been burned out. He's quite right there. They hadn't been bombed. They'd been burned out. And the Russians then show a video footage of a military vehicle with the convoy.
Who are these White Helmets?
Well, the White Helmets, did you know they get £28 million a year from the British government? The EU also fund them, and so do the US. And they're actually run by a guy called James Lemessurier, who's an ex-British intelligence officer, now running his own company. And, of course, he's got no background in civil defence. He's actually a psychological warfare officer. So what the White Helmets do is they go around taking selfies of themselves, digging people out of rubble and so on and so forth. But they operate only in areas controlled by Al-Qaeda. And the guys that was actually... The guy who actually shot the film of the little boy, for example, with the dusty little boy the other day, he was actually shown in another video where he's chatting with these guys who'd actually beheaded this Palestinian boy who was accused of being a spy for the Syrian government. Now, in other words, the White Helmets are not an independent civil defence force. They are embedded with Al-Qaeda and funded by MI6, run by this guy, Lemessurier. Now, in any decent world, Lemessurier should be in prison. And, of course, in some countries, he would have to be executed. But he's not. He's on our payroll. We are paying for that.
We heard on the 12th of this month, in The Guardian, Facebook and Israel are working together to monitor posts that incite violence. And then, literally this week, almost a kind of counter to that, Facebook apologises for disabling Palestinian journalists' accounts.
Well, we know that the big US... communications giants, the Facebook, Google, etc., are working with their intelligence services, A, to spy on people, and B, to spin propaganda for war. I mean, we know that, don't we?
What about back to the Shimon Peres' funeral? The guest list is pretty impressive, including Prince Charles, Boris Johnson, David Cameron, Tony Blair, Francois Hollande, and other heads of state. What do you make of this? A lot of people will be pointing the finger at the Israeli state and saying, well, actually, these people are fundamentalists from a Jewish point of view.
Well, Peres, to be fair, is regarded by the far right in Israel as a bit of a moderate and a bit of a liberal. That doesn't mean much in the real world, because I think he's very embedded within the intelligence structure of the Israeli state. And, you know, it's quite possible that he's been involved in a lot of the skullduggery we're discussing.
The kippah is this hat they wear. I mean, just putting a kippah on doesn't actually make you a Jew, does it?
Well, I mean, people can... Who is and who is not a Jew is actually a cause of considerable rancour within Israel itself.
I mean, is it a legitimate debate, or is it anti-Semitic just to discuss it?
Well, I mean, people are going to row and argue about it, because people row and argue about religious matters, as they always have. I mean, you know, some people say that the Pope's the Antichrist if they've got a very extreme Protestant view. It's not my view, but some people say it. You know, the Reverend Ian Paisley springs to mind, and somebody used to say that sort of thing.
Also, I suppose with this funeral, I mean, we should also mention that back in 2012 on this show, we broke this story about Ben Fellows and having infiltrated the security for the London Olympics. Shimon Peres was due to have his own special place, G4S had sorted out for him, right in the centre of the Olympic Park. And when he was denied that by the British Army when they took over, he said, oh, I'm not coming to the Olympics then.
Well, G4S have got a very strong relationship with the Israeli state. They run their prisons and other institutions, and the Israelis are very heavily embedded in that private security world.
Also, Robert Fisk wrote an article this week saying Shimon Peres was definitely not a man of peace.
Well, indeed, he's been presented in the West as a moderate, when in actual fact his record is not really that moderate at all. And You know, by their fruit shall you know them. I mean, the fact is that Israel as a society has drifted further and further to the right and more extreme as time has gone on.
Okay, finally, as I promised, breaking the taboo of religion in politics. This is a part of a talk by a chap called Eustace Mullins, who believes there's a lot of religion, hidden religion, involved in politics.
So everything within the occult is a mirror image of the Christian faith. There is Satan. There is the Antichrist. There is the false prophet. The one thing that's convinced me more than anything else is the validity of the scriptures is because these people believe in the Gospels. They believe in the Bible. They just hate everything that's there. And they have chosen to worship a different God. And this is really what motivates people at the highest levels of our government. Who is the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm? And if you read the President Bush's first inaugural address, this is how he concludes it, referring twice, not once, but twice to the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs the storm. It's Lucifer. Now, whether George Bush understands this or not, I don't know. He is part of a Luciferian organization. If you don't know anything about Skull and Bones, you need to get my 4-tape set on Skull and Bones. You need to get the new book we're carrying on satanic crimes because they've actually gotten in and gotten video cameras of the initiation at Skull and Bones. And as you know, both George Bush and his father and his grandfather and John Kerry, who ran against George Bush in 2004, they all come from Skull and Bones. And in the inauguration, they kneel before Lucifer. The book is, of course, Satanic Crimes, researched by a very courageous young man named William H. Kennedy. And it's available through our ministry. Understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Today, there is a conscious, organized effort to destroy the sovereignty of our nation. It is part of a worldwide plan. It is being carried out in Europe with the formation of the European Union. It doesn't matter that the people of France and of the Netherlands have voted against the Constitution. They don't care what the people want, you common people. You're standing in the way of progress, this wonderful dream that they've been working for thousands of years to accomplish.
The voice of Eustace Mullins there, certainly not necessarily the views on this show. But Martin, we were talking earlier, weren't we, about the whole business of the possibility of Deutsche Bank collapsing at some point, kind of Lehman Brothers style. But it's also true in the United States at the moment because Congress has rejected Obama's veto of this 9/11 bill. And the 9/11 bill was to stop the 9/11 bill will allow US citizens to sue the Saudis for the 9/11 attacks. Now, they've said that they're going to withdraw nearly $1 trillion worth of investments from the US if they allow this to go through, and Congress have just said it's going through.
Well, underlying all of this is that the Saudis, the Israelis and the NATO intelligence services were the main perpetrators of 9/11. And, of course, gradually it's coming out and they're all pointing the finger at each other. But, of course, for those of us on the outside, for example, the Russian General Staff and General Ivashov, who's now retired, it's all very interesting, isn't it? World War III is going to be a bit of a blinder for all of us.
But it's a bit like the child sex abuse inquiry we're talking about at the beginning. So it's difficult for the 9/11 victims and families right at the beginning. But what's worse is the cover-up. I mean, for example, they had somebody who was running their campaign who wasn't even a victim of 9/11 for about 4 or 5 years in the mid-2000s.
Well, indeed. And there's a chap called Matt, I've forgotten his second name, whose brother was killed in the Twin Towers, who's been campaigning in this country. Ultimately, this will come out as part of World War III. If we're going to war with Russia, the Russians are going to dump everything they've got on this out into the internet and give us telephone intercepts, everything we need.
OK, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips has the day off. Today's program is all about Banned Books Week. Yes, it's Banned Books Week, a week every year for over 30 years where we focus on the right to read and the right to know, and we oppose issues of censorship. Today's guests include Emily Knox, an assistant professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. We are also joined by James LaRue. He is the new director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. We'll be talking about Banned Books Week with our guests later in the program. We'll be joined by James Taggart. He is working with PEN America. He is their Free Expression Programs Manager. Stay with us for an hour on Banned Books Week.
Created by criminal minds, political ties, visualized alibis, skies, the guise of democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies of the ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's program, we focus for the hour on Banned Books Week, the annual celebration of the freedom to read, which is between September 25th and runs through October 1st. Hundreds of libraries, bookstores, schools, and communities across the country host events that celebrate free and open access to all literature, even those considered unorthodox or unpopular. And this year, the National Coalition for Banned Books Week is highlighting diversity. You can learn more about Banned Books Week at bannedbooksweek.org. Our guests for today include Emily Knox. Emily's an assistant professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her research interests include information access, intellectual freedom and censorship, information ethics and information policy, as well as the intersection of print culture and reading practices. Emily was awarded the Illinois Library Association Intellectual Freedom Award, was named a WISE Instructor of the Year in 2015. She is on the board of the Freedom to Read Foundation. Emily Knox, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hi.
We're also joined by James LaRue. James LaRue is the new director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom and the Freedom to Read Foundation. James LaRue has appeared on NPR, been quoted and highlighted in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Denver Post. He's hosted a local author interview TV program as well. A newspaper columnist for a quarter century, he also wrote The New Inquisition, Understanding and Managing Intellectual Freedom Challenges from 2007. He was a director of the Douglas County Library between 1990 and 2014, which was widely known as one of the most successful and innovative public libraries in the nation. He was the Colorado Librarian of the Year in 1998, and this year, 2016, he began his position with the American Library Association. James LaRue, welcome to the Project.
Thank you so much. That's a really long introduction, but I appreciate that.
James LaRue, tell us a little bit about the history of Banned Books Week over 30 years now.
Well, this started back around 1982, and there was a book festival that was going on in Anaheim, California, and someone got the bright idea of rounding up some of the books that were being frequently challenged, and I'll get to what challenge and banned means in just a moment. And they put them kind of in a cage in the middle of this exhibit hall, and it attracted such attention. They said, you know, we got a good gimmick on our hands here. Let's start rounding up all of these challenged authors and really point out that there are people in America who don't want you to read them. So since then, there has been this annual event that probably gets more attention than and almost anything American Library Association does to say we are protecting your freedom to read, your First Amendment rights. And so every year we have a chance to talk about what America is nervous about these days.
This year's theme is diversity, so apparently there must be some nervousness going on around diversity. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, there sure is. The Office for Intellectual Freedom receives these challenges, which are formal attempts to remove books from libraries, from the people that are trying to defend those books, or we see read them in the newspaper, or we see them on the web, and we kind of just collect all this data. And so one of the things that we have noticed is that for probably the past 20 years, maybe half of those books were challenged because they were by diverse authors or about diverse content. And in 2015, we noticed that 9 out of the top 10 were about diverse issues. And by diverse, I mean people of color, LGBT, disabled in some fashion, or a minority, cultural, or religious community. 9 out of 10 really means that something is going on here in America.
Indeed it is. And Emily Knox, let's bring you in. And what can you add to what James LaRue is saying about this year's theme for Banned Books Week, diversity?
This is something that I've just started a little bit of research on, looking at the books that have been challenged recently. And what I'm really interested in is why these books are being challenged. And it looks like, in some ways, the books are being challenged because they are diverse, right? They're being challenged because they're about bisexuality or they're about racism. And of course, this is intrinsic to being a diverse book. And I hope to explore this more as I go through my research on it.
You are author of a book that's titled Book Banning in the 21st Century, Roman Littlefield book from 2015. Tell us a little bit about that. What does book banning look like in the 21st century?
The cases that I look at are really about challenges. So we haven't gotten to the difference between that. But a book challenge is when someone asks for a book be restricted, removed, or relocated. And I look at the reasons why people ask for this, and I'm really interested in what people think that reading does to people and why certain things that are going to be read should be removed or restricted from somebody. For that work, what I do is I interview challengers, and I go to hearings or watch videotapes of hearings on books that are challenged, and I also do Freedom of Information Act requests from the institutions to get as much documentation of the challenge as possible.
James LaRue, let's bring you back in here. You know a thing or two about banning and challenging. Talk to us a little bit about your definitions of the differences and maybe talk about why that's significant.
I absolutely share Emily's interest in this. And when I started, I think I had hit 150 challenges when I was the director of the library. And I said, what is going on here? And why are people so exercised about some of these issues? Because on the face of it, if you say, okay, well, if I have a viewpoint or if I read a book, it doesn't change my behavior overnight. I've read a lot of mysteries in my life, and I've yet to kill anybody. Now, I've read a cookbook once, but I didn't cook anything out of it, you know? So just reading something doesn't change your behavior. But then I noticed that the pattern fell into one of two categories, is 99% of the challenges that I got were coming from parents of children between the ages of 4 and 6 or 14 and 16. And then I realized that it's not just about a religious versus secular or liberal versus conservative, and really was about this moment in parenthood where you say, I am losing control of my child's environment. And between the ages of 4 and 6, you know, suddenly that protective cocoon is breaking down because your child is going to daycare or going to play dates or is going to preschool. And so now you don't have the same control over their environment, and it's about love and loss and grief. You want your baby back. And between 14 and 16, of course, it's the second loss of innocence. It's the end of childhood and the beginning of adulthood. And so I think that often what happens is the parent sees this kind of moment where I'm about to lose something, and they want to protect you and surround you in this kind of gloss of innocence, not really recognizing that innocence doesn't protect you from the dangers of the world. The world is still out there, and reading about it is often your very best defense to get ready for it.
Let's say, then, that a book is challenged. For example, let's play devil's advocate in this case. If someone says, well, is the book really banned? If someone's challenging it, or is it taken off the shelf, so to speak? Emily Knox, do you want to address that concern?
This actually comes up a lot, and I actually have a paper that I wrote about this, about the differences between broad definitions of censorship and narrow definitions of censorship. So if someone says the book is taken off the shelf, that it's not really banned, this is a narrow definition of censorship, right? But because you can get it somewhere else, that the book hasn't been banned. But in fact, what you're doing is you're impeding access to the book, right? Why else would you ask for someone to remove a book if you didn't feel that by removing it, you would be impeding access? And I think it's important to always remember that that's actually the goal of a challenge, is to in some way prescribe how a particular book should be used. And what libraries are in is the business of access and providing as much access as possible. And so if someone says that, well, we're just taking it off the book, off the shelf, what I talk about in my book is that actually this is a symbolic act in many ways, right? It's trying to say, this is the kind of community that we have. This is the kind of library that should represent our community in a particular way. So I think it's easier to see it as not so much, well, no one can ever see this book again, but what is the person trying to say about the institution of the library and the community in which they live?
Well, it's almost like community policing or something.
And I think it's a state of identity. It's like, we believe this, when often it isn't a majority view. It's just a very loud view.
Emily, you wanted to say?
I think community policing is one way to see it, but also it's also a measure of thinking about, we're a society that's going through so many changes at the moment, and one thing that people feel that they can have control over is their local institutions. And one of those local institutions is the library, whether the public library, the school library. And this is a way of saying, well, I'm kind of putting my foot down here, and I'm actually going to take a stand about what we think our community should look like.
So, James LaRue, this, of course, then looks different regionally. And, you know, many of us live in, you know, urban metropolitan environments where, you know, there's a lot of diversity. But, of course, not everyone lives in a very diverse area. So how do you see some differences there? Or do you see differences in seeing challenges or bans taking place in different places or suburban or maybe even rural places?
I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about that notion about whether or not a book is banned. And I was talking to a reporter here recently who was saying that in her little town in Nevada, if they remove a book from a school library, you say, well, is it really banned? You say, well, how close is your nearest bookstore? And it turns out it was 80 miles away. And there was no public library in this very small community. And he says, oh, but it's available on Amazon. And say, well, how many teenagers who are grappling with issues about, you know, sexual identity have a credit card and can go to Amazon and order the book? So I think sometimes in the more rural areas, the banning of a book from an institution, in fact, bans it from an entire community. But don't think that censorship only happens in rural areas. In fact, we see it happening in very large cities. Most often lately, it seems like there's a new kind of challenge that's happening in schools, very much targeting schools. And here the idea is, if this book is going to disturb my child, meaning it has sexual content, Toni Morrison's Beloved, there's are rape scenes in it. Well, I don't want my child, who is 17 years old and will be able to marry and vote and go to war the next year, I don't want them to know about this. And so you should notify the parents that there might be disturbing content in this book so we can give them an alternative book to read.
Well, James LaRue, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm actually very interested in hearing what you and Emily Knox have to say about this. This sort of been going on just kind of in a broader conversation going on, not just in higher education, but culturally in the United States, about trigger warnings.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that, Emily Knox?
Well, I'm actually editing a book for Ronan Littlefield about trigger warnings. Mm-hmm. It should be out in the spring. I think trigger warnings are very difficult to really get a handle on. There are many people who feel that if you don't put a trigger warning before a book, that in fact you don't care about your students, right? They can be seen like as a way of, I heard someone recently say, you know, a way of signaling that you are understanding of a particular way, particular aspect of society and thinking about people who deal with trauma. My main concern about trigger warnings actually relates to diverse books. My fear is that, in fact, trigger warnings will be assigned to books about people from diverse populations because, in fact, those populations tend to have more trauma in them. And I think Beloved is an excellent example of this, right? It is a very violent book, but is it a book that deserves a trigger warning? It's a book about slavery in the United States. the effects of that. Mm-hmm. It's not that the book is not traumatic. It's just my fear with trigger warnings is that, in fact, these are the books that will have them more than books about, say, the majority population, however that's defined. In my book that's coming out in the spring, people take all different points of view on trigger warnings, from either having them or not having, having them institutionally required or not.
Well, that's another can of worms there. If they're mandated, yep. that's a very different situation. And if you take a look, of course, at people like Greg Lukianoff at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, who kind of was part of sparking this more recent debate in the last year with the Atlantic article. And then, of course, James LaRue, the University of Chicago's. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, and I, much like Emily, I find quite a diversity of opinion about trigger warnings. If I talk to my own daughter about this, she says, hey, you know, this is not an attempt to censor. This is an attempt to say that there really are people who have suffered mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress. And you're not saying we're not going to talk about it. We're just going to give you a moment before I talk about a difficult scene to say this is going to feature something that we know could trigger post-traumatic things. So it is I'm showing you a movie that's about, you know, violence that takes place that could trigger something that happened to you in Afghanistan. But the problem is that other people, and I think the University of Chicago took this tack too, is that, you know, how many things do we have to warn you about? Because if it's two things, if it's rape and war, you know, okay, you can say, I can understand that a good professor would say, we're going to talk about some things that may be difficult for some of you. Just take a breath, and right. Here we go. Right. But I've seen a list of trigger warnings that gets down to the point to say, well, there are people who are afraid of spiders. And now if I'm reading a short story, do I have to say there are spiders in this story? And that's how the American Library Association winds up saying that warning itself is a way to scare people away from the content. Well, if there's a warning label attached to it, then I shouldn't have to do it, right?
We're speaking with James LaRue. He's director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. We're also speaking with Emily Knox, assistant professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also author of Book Burning in 21st Century America, published by Roman and Littlefield. We're talking about Banned Books Week. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, and we will be back after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. This week on the Project Censored Show, we're talking about Banned Books Week taking place now. And we're joined by James LaRue. He's director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. We're also joined by assistant professor in the School of Information Sciences at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, Emily Knox. Emily Knox is also the author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. Emily, we were talking about trigger warnings, and it is a complicated and nuanced subject, and James LaRue was pointing that out and making some commentary about that. Could you build on that and talk a little bit more about this, especially given that you have a book coming out next year?
I would say that when it comes to the classroom, like if I have my students reading something that is difficult, I might say something like, be aware that there's something in here. You know, there are things in here that are violent. I just want you to know that. I don't know if I would use the word trigger warning or content warning for it. For librarians, what we worry about quite a bit is that labels are performative. So when you label something as a book that is violent or a book that is erotic or something like that, the book becomes that thing. This is something I'm constantly talking to my students about. This is also something that comes up with challenges. So you get people who say, well, this is a book for adults. This is a book for teenagers, as if these labels make the book become something. And so Library and Information Science is always just a little wary of labeling things like this, because once you've done this performative act on a text, it's hard to think of it any other way. I mean, this is true of almost all media. Once you have said that it is this one thing, people are primed to think of it in a particular way. And that's one of the things I worry about with trigger warnings, that the texts themselves become a trigger, right? They no longer will have maybe resonance as literature or as art, because they've become triggers for someone if you put a trigger warning on it. There are many people who disagree with this, and that is what I hope will come up in my book. I'm not trying to put forward something that is definitive in the book. There are lots of different ideas coming through there.
Oh, surely there are. You're describing a little bit of what sounds like framing, and the notion that you're potentially predisposing someone to a particular framed interpretation merely by highlighting something that is a potential trigger warning, even though you're missing potential broader interpretation or overall ways of thinking about a particular work, whether it's literature, art, even news for that matter.
Right. And this is when it comes up with challenges. So I just saw something on a Facebook group that talked about The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, which is a book that gets challenged all the time. And the person came up to the reference desk and said, well, this is a book for kids. I mean, like for young kids, because it has pictures in it, right? So this person was putting a frame and making this book for a particular subset of kids because of the way in which the author and illustrator chose to tell their story. And this is something that comes up with Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian quite a bit, that why should you read this as a teenager or as an adult, because it has pictures. And of course, this also goes to graphic novels, which was the focus for in Book Week last year, because when you think about, like, what is a graphic novel? How can those be for adults? There are a lot of people who would say, well, adults shouldn't read them, even though you have a graphic novel like most, which is definitely something that deals with adult topics.
James LaRue, I want to bring you back into the conversation here. The ALA's top 10 challenged books list, a lot of these fall under diverse content. You had mentioned that earlier. And a lot of the challenge works are often about people or issues that include LGBTQIA, people of color, gender diversity, ethnic, cultural, religious minorities, people with so-called disabilities. People are issues that perhaps challengers would prefer not to consider. So this is what we're getting at in terms of diverse content. But it's also an issue that there's a lack of diversity in library collections, is it not?
Well, that's true. So one of the things I've been looking at, so you start off and say 9 of these 10 titles are diverse content. And then you look at the publishing world and say, okay, so a big study came out by Lee and Loam, and they said that at this point, the vast percentage of publishing, about 90% by some estimates, and maybe 86% by others, is pretty much mainstream white Anglo-Saxon Protestant sort of lifestyles, right? Everybody's straight and white. So why haven't we seen much shift in mainstream publishing? And by mainstream publishing, I mean just the big five publishers who predominate the content that is advertised and pushed all throughout the commercial bookstores and the libraries around the nation. And they just haven't changed very much in terms of the people who are administering these programs. And at the same time, there's an extraordinary explosion of writing that's happening around the world, but particularly in America, of small, independent, and self-published content. And that content is diverse. So one of the things that we started talking about at the Office of Intellectual Freedom is that, is there a way for us to start looking and mining our own backyard a little better to identify these emerging voices who haven't gone through all the traditional gatekeeping to go through an agent, to go through an editor, and go through a publisher, and then have to be reviewed? People are going right to Amazon and publishing the book, and it gets out in a week, and it happens to reflect people's real lives, and it's immediately available, but it's not in our libraries. So this Our Voices effort, that we're calling it, is to try to find a way to find quality, diverse, local content produced in our neighborhood and get it into our libraries.
That sounds like an important initiative. Is this something that you're launching now?
Yes. In fact, we are launching it at this year's Banned Books Week.
So that's very, very timely. This sounds like a very important initiative, and certainly at Project Censored, we've noticed some of the same challenges in getting material out in timely fashion. Our publishers of Seven Stories Press, you know, independent publisher, 90% of media is controlled by about six corporations. Certainly, right. Certainly Seven Stories Press, not one of those. But, you know, again, that is part of the challenge, is sort of, you know, books take time to produce, it seems, if you're going through, you know, these kinds of channels. And there are new technologies where you are rightly saying there's a lot of diverse content coming out. It's just coming out in different places. Emily Knox, can you comment on that and your experience with that, with technology and diversity?
I definitely think that there is more written, more online. One of the things I've always been interested in is things like urban fiction and self-publishing of, well, it's euphemistically called urban fiction, and how people have more access to get their ideas published than they used to. And some of my stories are about people who have written a story and go out and get it printed up and then sell it out of the trunk of their car, you know, in their neighborhood, in the city. And my hope is that as we move to lowering the barriers to publishing in general, that more voices will get out there. But I am also worried, when it comes to challenge books, that in fact we'll see more challenges because there won't be as many gatekeepers. And this is one of the arguments that challengers use anyway. They say, how did this get published? The publishers should be ashamed of themselves for letting this trash get out there. And so we don't quite know what will happen when libraries, say, take in thousands of books in a collection because they're all just available for download on your e-reader. And how will challenges happen because your kid is able to see not just one book, but say 50 books on a particular topic that might not have gone through the same selection process that's used in libraries right now. So we'll see how that goes.
James LaRue, we're going to be bringing this segment of the program to a close here momentarily, and then we'll be continuing with James Tager and Emily Knox. I believe you're going to stay on the program with us. But James LaRue, this is your first year at the ALA Office of Freedom as the director there. How has this year been going? And this is your first Banned Books Week as director of OIF.
The whole thing has been fascinating to me. This is Intellectual Freedom Central, and that means that all of the news reports and everybody is constantly tracking and alert for all this, and so it's been thrilling to get thrown right into the heart of all of the debates of our society. So I'm having a wonderful time.
Indeed, I bet you are. And Project Censored is a proud sponsor, contributor to Banned
Yes.
Books Week for several years. And the work that you do at the American Library Association, the Office for Intellectual Freedom to Read Foundation, we couldn't be more supportive of what's happening there. And we really hope that more and more people really pay more attention to this and go to bannedbooksweek.org to learn more that, yes, indeed, there are bans and there are challenges. And this year's theme of diversity is incredibly timely, given the many things taking place in the United States and around the world today. So, James LaRue, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show. Again, bannedbooksweek.org. You can also go to ala.org/offices/OIF to learn more about the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. James LaRue, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Emily Knox, we're going to keep you on for the rest of the show. And after this musical break, we're going to be joined by James Tager. Please stay with us. Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, and today's theme is Banned Books Week. And this year's theme, Banned Books Week, is celebrating diversity. And if you go to the bannedbooksweek.org website, you can see a list of frequently challenged books with diverse content. And according to the Banned Books Week site, they say, while diversity is seldom given as a reason for a challenge, it seems, in fact, to be an underlying and unspoken factor. These challenged works are often about people and issues which include LGBTQIA, people of color, gender diversity, people with disabilities and ethnic, cultural, and religious minorities, people or issues that perhaps challengers would prefer not to consider. Among some of these titles, A Gathering of Old Men by Ernest Gaines, A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich by Alice Childress, A Lesson Before Dying by Ernest Gaines, Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie, All American Boys by Jason Reynolds, Always Running by Luis Rodriguez, Am I Blue? Coming Out from the Silence by Marion Dane Bau, and Tango Makes Three by Justin Richardson and Peter Parnell, Anne Frank, The Diary of a Girl, still on the list of challenged and banned books. And another is Annie on My Mind by Nancy Garden. Later in the program, we'll read some other of these challenged books. And again, you're invited to go to bannedbooksweek.org. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. This week, we're focusing on Banned Books Week. It's an annual celebration of the freedom to read. This year is between September 25th and October 1st. Hundreds of libraries, bookstores, schools, communities across the country host events that celebrate free and open access to all literature, even those considered unorthodox or unpopular. And this year, the national coalition that is behind Banned Books Week is highlighting diversity. In the first part of the show today, we were joined by James LaRue, the director of the American Library Association, the Office for Intellectual Freedom. And now we are joined by James Tager. He is the program manager for PEN America's Free Expression Program, previously worked with the International Commission of Jurists, Asia and Pacific Program. And before this, He was a Frederick Sheldon Traveling Fellow researching civil society responses to developing human rights framework within the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And James holds a BA from Duke University, a JD from Harvard Law School, licensed to practice in the state of New York. James Tager, thanks for joining the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
And we are still joined by Emily Knox. Emily, a reminder to listeners, or if you're just tuning in, Emily Knox is assistant professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her recent book is called Book Banning in 21st Century America. So, James Tager, since you're just now joining us, we were talking before you came on about a history of Banned Books Week. We got into a little bit of the theme of this year's Banned Books Week, diversity. We also had talked about trigger warnings, a whole host of things. But let's just start with you. What's first and foremost on your mind for this year's Banned Books Week and the theme of diversity?
Oh, that's such a good question. Obviously, to begin with is the broad overview of this idea that it's diverse books that are disproportionately targeted to be challenged or banned. And I'm using the term diverse books to refer to books written by or featuring characters of color or of LGBT people or disabled. As we become more of a diverse society, especially as we have more and more children of color making up now, I believe, more than half of the kids in public schools in the United States, the necessity for books that highlight diverse experiences, diverse characters, and written by people of color, LGBT authors or others, becomes more and more important. And we have a report, PEN America is putting out a report to coincide with Banned Book Week called Missing from the Shelf. And what's on my mind now is the idea that we'll have cases that will explode into the public consciousness about banned books or challenged books. And there will be rightfully a big outcry over the concept of banned books. What troubles me particularly is those stories that don't reach the public consciousness. Books that are banned or challenged in an informal way where it never reaches the news, where people never hear about it, and thus there never gets to be that backlash against censorship that's so useful for getting out the word that book banning and book challenges is still a thing.
Well, indeed, it is a thing, and that's a good point to bring up, because I know in classrooms we talk a little bit about Banned Books Week, or I talk about censorship, and often people say censorship in America, banned books in America, and of course it actually is a big thing here. It's just that I think people are predisposed maybe to not think about these things, or certainly with this year's Banned Books Week theme, people that either have some a lack of familiarity or issues with themes of diversity, they may tend not to pay attention to them or are just wholly unaware that there are viewpoints that have a really hard time getting the light of day or getting a fair hearing. And Emily Knox, let's bring you back into the conversation and let's talk about some of those kinds of challenges, or perhaps let's spin this on its head instead of just focusing on the challenges. Maybe talk about what are some things that we can all do to resist challenges in the banning of books and ways that we can really get people to open up to the themes of diversity.
Well, there's a couple things to talk about with this. One thing is self-censorship. So in libraries, one thing I'm going to be looking at with the Illinois Library Association is whether or not are librarians engaging in self-censorship? Do you ever think about, not getting something because you are worried that it will cause controversy in your community? And what do you do to mitigate that if you are engaging in that? The other thing that comes up are, I always encourage all of my students to have really good policies. So it is true that sometimes these never reach the light of day, but my hope is that, and sometimes that happens because, in fact, the challenge has been stopped at the desk. That's what I call it. So if someone comes up with a concern, and actually following from Jamie LaRue's book on this, the Inquisition, that you're able to find someone a book that they would like better. It is a problem, though, if it's just kind of hushed up and the book is just kind of moved. And how do we make sure that that doesn't happen? Well, one way to do that is to make sure that there's support from the community. If you hear that this is happening in your community, it's really important to let the staff, the director, know that you support them. And I would say even if it's a book that you don't necessarily like yourself, this often comes up with the book's called TTYL. They are all based on kids' text speak. A lot of people dislike these books, but they're very important for a lot of young adults and teenagers, and they're often challenged. And I would say that for the institutions that are going through these challenges, knowing that there are people out there to support you really can make a difference for how much anxiety and stress you have while you're going through this challenge. And also getting kids' voices involved. So in my research, as I mentioned before, I often go to hearings or watch videos of hearings that happen. And there's nothing more powerful than hearing the voices of kids who have been touched by these different books that they've read. Often their testimony in front of the board can really make a difference. And I can't stress that enough, to really get people on your side and just show up, you know. If there's going to be a hearing, show up and support the school or public library.
James Tager, let's bring you here. What are your thoughts on some things that we can do to push back? Not just push back maybe in a combative way, but push back in a didactic way.
I think one thing that I'm proud to say PEN America's report focuses on and that is relevant is the publishing industry and the role they play in making sure that books with diverse viewpoints, featuring diverse characters, and written by diverse authors, including authors of color, LGBTQ authors, that they reach publication in the first place. So one way we can kind of push back against the idea of censorship of diversity is to make sure that these books are available in the first place, to send the message to publishers that these are the types of books we're interested in reading. One of the most interesting things we found for the research for our report is both at the distribution point and at the publication point, people would push back against diverse books or books by diverse authors by saying, well, we don't really find this relevant to our own experiences. We can't relate, both in terms of librarians and school teachers saying, well, our kids won't be able to relate. And also kind of editors saying, well, we're not sure we're going to publish this book because we can't relate. We spoke to Daniel Jose Elder, the author, about his experiences, and he told us a story where he said people told him that, well, we can't relate to your character. We think it's great writing, but we can't relate to your character. He said, well, my character is a 16-year-old woman of color, and you're a 30-year-old white woman. You're not supposed to relate. So we have to kind of push this idea that we don't have to relate personally to a book in the sense that we don't have to believe that we can picture ourselves looking in the mirror and seeing the characters in order to find that book to be a valuable one.
We're speaking with James Tager. He is program manager for PEN America's Free Expression Program. Also, we've been joined for the hour by Emily Knox, author most recently of Book Banning in 21st Century America. The theme of today's show has been Banned Books Week, and we will continue our conversation for the last segment of the Project Censored show today after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're continuing our conversation today about Banned Books Week. We're joined by James Tager, the program manager for PEN America's Free Expression Program, and Emily Knox, who is an assistant professor in the School of Information Sciences at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. Emily Knox, you wanted to say something more about diverse books. Please do.
I always think that the idea that somehow, as James mentioned, that you have to relate to a book in order for it to be something that you should, you know, publish or that you should buy is very interesting, because for so many years, those of us who are people of color are always expected to read about white people, or if you're LGBTQIA, you're supposed to read if you were only reading about people who are heterosexual. And so the relationship seems to only want to go in one direction, right? And the idea that, well, I don't want to read this because, or I don't want to publish this because it's not related to me. I mean, this is really, I know people dislike the word privilege, but of course this is the ultimate privilege, that somehow, even in your literature, that the world is supposed to be reflective of you. And this has never been true for people who are part of diverse populations, right? We've never said that the world of literature should be reflective of us. And it's interesting to see how much pushback there has been about this changing literary landscape to actually match much more what our country looks like.
Indeed. And James Tager, let's talk a little bit more about this PEN report on BannedBooksWeek.org. You know, right up front, the Association of American Publishers has a little bit of information about the kind of books that are banned, and it talks about some statistics between 1994 and 2012. 37% of the U.S. population are people of color, but only 10% of books published focus on multicultural content. Over half of books challenged or banned in the past decade have diverse content. Of course, these are troubling kinds of statistics in terms of equity, but talk to us a little bit more about the PEN report and how it addresses some of this.
Absolutely. I want to start, before I jump into that, by just affirming everything that Emily said. And I think also in terms of, you know, how we expect readers and children to relate to books, it's also important to point out that when we kind of try to categorize children as relating to books only with characters that might physically look like them or might have the same life experiences, we forget that kids, like anyone else, can think thematically and can relate to a character who's going through something similar, experiencing similar thematic issues, regardless of kind of whether they identify with the gender or the sexual orientation or gender identity or the racial background of the character. So I just want to kind of affirm and elaborate on that. But in terms of our report, which, again, if you'll forgive the shameless plugging, you can find at www.pen.org.
No, this is why we're here. We're here to spread the word and get people finding out. So please repeat that.
www.pen.org. The report is called Missing from the Shelf. And we talk not only about the concept of lack of diversity in book challenges in children's literature, but also the idea of looking at the publishing industry and how we need to encourage them to publish more diverse works. And, you know, one thing that stands out to me is this idea that the publishing industry is considered this passion industry. And you get into it because you have a passion for the writing. And, of course, there are kind of systemic norms where editors may privilege certain books that they see as kind of more in their wheelhouse. And, unfortunately, that ties into this idea that experiences they've had in their own life and their own privileges to use the same concept that Emily was saying is something we need to make sure is in here, is something that affects their choices for what books they publish. You know, we also want to talk about the idea that more and more we're having a conversation about how the need for diverse books affects our conceptions of books today that have offensive representations of people of color. And at PEN America, we're a big believer in the idea that if there's bad speech or offensive speech, or in this situation, books that have, you know, offensive representations of people of color, that a way to deal with that is more speech, to ensure that there's, you know, loud voices pointing out exactly what's wrong and having a conversation about that. That's kind of what the report walks us through. But as you affirmed and as our report affirms, unfortunately, nowadays, you know, many of the book challenges, the majority of the book challenges focus on challenging books written by or having characters of color or LGBTQ or disabled. And that's something that I think we at Penn think is deeply troubling, and I think the average person should find deeply troubling.
So, Emily Knox, I wanted to remind listeners also, Emily, people can learn more about you and your work at emilyknox.net. That's Emily, K-N-O-X.net. But, Emily, could you add to what James was talking about? In terms of, let's go back to the Banned Books Week theme of diversity and the, really the significance of what it really means to be having books. We've seen the statistics that there are few books that get to the libraries and shelves that are about diversity, yet they seem to be the books that are even more and more challenged. So this is certainly a challenge for trying to create an educated multicultural society.
So what I found in my research is that, in fact, the way that book challenges work is that they follow whatever problems are happening in society. One of the most interesting things that one of my challengers told me was that, you know, this book is no Catcher in the Rye, which is a book, of course, that was challenged and banned for many, many years. But the rise of, and I think we'll continue to see the rise of challenges to diverse books because of the changes we're seeing in society. That we're expected to be a minority country in 2040. Books and literature help us understand what is going on in our own world. And as we see more and more books about diverse populations get published or just are available in general, it's actually just not even surprising that these are the books that people are challenging. Because, of course, this is a difficult topic. Societal change is always difficult. How do you wrestle with that? And as I mentioned earlier, you know, this is a way of wrestling with it in your immediate community, within your own public library, your own school library, your own bookstore. And I think that expecting this to go away soon is just not actually realistic.
Oh, no.
This happened more and more and more.
And Emily Knox, I'm glad that you remind us, as you did earlier, that this is a very local issue, and it's important for people to be paying attention and supporting the community's right to read.
Yes, absolutely.
So, James Tager, a list this year of some of the top books, A Gathering of Old Men, Ernest J. Gaines, A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich, Alice Childress, another Gaines book, A Lesson Before Dying. There's Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, Sherman Alexie, right? That's still there.
We're still staying strong.
Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap up the segment here, but I just wanted to see, could you talk a little, just very briefly about, you know, maybe a title two here, or at least some of the consistency about what's happening. And some of these books end up on the list year after year.
Yeah. Well, in a way that can wrap up, but also follow on what was just said, you know, there's this idea that these are issues that make people uncomfortable, issues of kind of racial history. For example, Toni Morrison's Beloved, which was challenged in Virginia, and quite literally the son of the challenger who had read the book said he found the book gross. And you can interpret that to mean, well, I was uncomfortable with the book's material. And a lot of these books are things that deal with themes that make people uncomfortable or discomfited. But they make people uncomfortable precisely because they're things we have to spend a lot of time thinking about, and they illuminate some of the fault lines and some of the major issues in society today. And when you challenge a book or attempt to ban a book that deals with these issues, in essence, on one level, you're saying, well, we don't want to discuss these issues. We don't want to bring them into the public forum, and we don't want to bring them before our children to discuss. And I think Pen America, and I think the National Coalition Against Censorship and others, you know, we just disagree with that approach fundamentally.
Indeed. And we certainly do at Project Censored. This is the voice of James Tager, Free Expression Program Manager, Pen America, pen.org. We've also been joined by Emily Knox, author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. You can learn more at emilyknox.net. You can go and learn more about Banned Books Week also at bannedbooksweek.org. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us today, and I'm afraid we're out of time. time, but would also like to remind our listeners that we should think about Banned Books Week every week, not just once a year, as we champion the right to free expression and the right to know. James Tager, Emily Knox, thank you so much for your time on the Project Centered Show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Project Centered Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. The focus today is Banned Books Week, and I would like to continue sharing with everyone some more of the books that are commonly challenged or banned according to the Banned Books Week site. Autobiography of Malcolm X, Alex Haley. Baby Bebop by Francisca Leah Block. Beloved by Toni Morrison. Beyond Magenta, Transgender Teens Speak Out by Susan Coughlin. Black Boy by Richard Wright. Bless Me, Utima by Rodolfo A. Anaya. Color of Earth by Kim Dong-hwa. Daddy's Roommate by Michael Lehot. Drama by Raina Telgemeier. Fallen Angels by Walter Dean Myers. There are many of these books, and there is a long list of them available, over 50, in fact. And the source for this was the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. For more of that information, you can visit bannedbooksweek.org.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
And that wraps up another Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, your host. Our show today has been about Banned Books Week. We give thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. Erica Bridgman is our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on 35 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. Please visit Facebook and follow our activities. Also, learn more about Project Censored online at projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Arctic Amplification, Climate Change and Global Warming, New Challenges from the Top of the World, Professor Peter Warams. The major cause of today's sea level rise is the melting of the 2-mile-thick Greenland ice sheet. And that in turn is caused by the warming of the Arctic. The planet is now circled by satellites that measure ice thickness, temperature, methane emissions, and more. They show that the Arctic is heating up much faster than the rest of the planet. It seems counterintuitive at first, since the Arctic was recently so cold that some explorers and ships that dared go there were never seen again. None of them would have thought they needed a boat to get to the North Pole. However, today, the Arctic is no longer the refrigerator of the Earth, but instead may be the most dramatic expression of a dreaded tipping point or feedback loop in climate. Fossil fuel emissions caused the melting of the Arctic ice. Now the Arctic is accelerating global warming instead of cooling the planet because of the disappearance or thinning off the ice sheet in the Arctic summer. This ice sheet that covered the top of the world and touched the coastlines of Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and Siberia for 100,000 years has been rapidly shrinking during the Arctic summer, and that took only 30 years. And the Arctic winter is no longer cold enough to restore the ice to the former level. Professor Peter Wadhams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist and was director of the Scott Polar Institute in Cambridge from 1987 to 1992. He was professor of ocean physics at Cambridge from 1992 to 2015. He has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions. His most recent book is A Farewell to Ice. In this extraordinary, comprehensive lecture that he gave in Milano, Italy, in May 2015, Wadhams lists 7 major areas in which the Arctic determines climate change. In the previous program by TUC Radio, Wadhams explained how the Arctic sea ice is shrinking and thinning, and I encourage you to go back to the website or podcast to listen to that again for free at tucradio.org. Now you are about to hear his research results on the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. The multinational study on the recent discovery of methane releases from permafrost and shallow water, the link between sea ice loss and the extreme weather events we have already experienced, and the churning and deflections of 2 great global air and water currents, the jet stream and the thermohaline circulation. So now we are rejoining the lecture that Peter Wadhams gave in Milano, Italy. As we know, floating sea ice that melts does not affect sea level. However, melting ice on land does. Professor Peter Wadhams takes us to Greenland.
The retreat of sea ice allows warmer air to get into the Arctic, and that's having an impact on global sea levels. What we find is that in November, when the ice should be freezing up again, it's not freezing over yet. So there's still lots of open water north of Alaska and north of Siberia. It's more than 20 degrees warmer than it ought to be because there's still open water and there isn't any ice there yet. So the water is warming, and that's warming the air. The air masses in the Arctic in summer are now much warmer than they used to be. That includes the surface of the ice sheet covering Greenland. And if we look at the Greenland ice sheet, which is a huge mass of ice, 2 miles thick, it used to just get some melt on it around the edges in summer because the altitude was low, so the edges of the ice sheet would melt, the centre wouldn't. But in 2012, 97% of the ice sheet was covered with meltwater, so there was a much increased area of melt going on. So this meltwater ends up in the ocean. It melts on the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. It runs off or it runs down through the ice sheet to the bedrock and then runs out to sea. And that's increasing the amount of water in the ocean, which means it's increasing global sea levels. Up until 2007, this IPCC, this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was making very modest predictions about how global sea level would rise the rest of this century. But as soon as they started to see the Greenland ice sheet melting, and it's also happening a little bit in the Antarctic, that's also melting, this is the new estimate of how much sea level rise there'll be by the end of this century, and it's already up above 1 metre. And if we think about what 1 metre of sea level rise is going to do, that's a pretty massive effect all over the world. Locally, for instance, that would be enough to overwhelm the Venice gates, the flood defences in Venice. All the holiday resorts along the Adriatic would be affected. in Western Europe, Holland and Eastern England would be affected. In Europe, it's bad, but it's much worse in poorer countries like Bangladesh, where you would have very severe increase in the numbers of flood disasters. And in America, you'd have to abandon certain cities like Miami and New Orleans would just have to be abandoned. So this estimate of 1 meter of sea level rise this century is a very, very serious business. You get more and more flood disasters in the Bay of Bengal, eastern China, and these flood disasters kill hundreds of thousands of people. It's not like something in Europe that would only kill a few people. So this is a very serious effect that's coming along and is happening now, being caused mainly by the loss of ice from the Greenland ice sheet, and that's being caused mainly by the warming of the Arctic Ocean and the loss of sea ice. So the next effect in the story of doom is the loss of snow. So the snow line retreat is enhancing the albedo feedback. This area in the Northern Hemisphere is a departure from the norm. You used to, of course, have a lot of snow in everywhere, including Europe, in winter, but certainly the whole of the north of Canada and the north of Siberia would be snow-covered right through the winter into the summer. But now, if you look in June, you find areas are snow-free in June. And the decrease in area of snow in June, which is when there's most solar radiation, is now reached 6 million square kilometres compared to the average back in the 1970s. Now, 6 million square kilometres is about the area of ice that there is in the Arctic Ocean. So the retreat of the snow in early summer is as great as the retreat of the sea ice. And it has the same effect on albedo. If the snow disappears, you're left with land, you're left with forest, tundra, dark stuff, which absorbs more solar radiation. So it's exactly the same effect. It's reducing the average albedo of the planet. And so really, the Arctic is adding about a half to the direct effect of adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. We think we're doing something to the planet. We are. But whatever we're doing directly from the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere, we're increasing that by 50% by the fact that warming is causing the sea ice to retreat and it's causing the snow line to retreat. Now, another really serious threat, which we're studying at the moment with a European research program, and it's the fact that we might have a great outburst of methane coming from the seabed. When the sea ice retreats in the Arctic, it's retreating in the summer just to the centre of the Arctic. Now, the centre of the Arctic is very deep water. It's a proper ocean, 4,000 or 5,000 metres deep. But it's retreating away from the shoreline, and the coastal regions of the Arctic are actually very shallow water. This water is less than 100 metres deep. So in the Barents Sea, the Kara Sea, the Laptev Sea, the East Siberian Sea, all the seas north of Siberia, the water is very, very shallow, 50 to 100 metres water depth. And until recently, that was still covered with ice in the summer. But as soon as it retreats, you have this area which is now ice-free in summer and very shallow. So it can absorb solar radiation and the whole water mass can warm up. And we've seen that happen. This is 2007, Alaska, Siberia. The ice used to fill the whole of this area in summer and the water warmed up to 5 degrees, more than 5 degrees centigrade. Now, that doesn't seem very warm, but it is because it used to be down at freezing point, even in the summer. You warm it up to 5 degrees and that warm water reaches down to the seabed and starts melting the frozen sediments on the seabed, which is called offshore permafrost. It's permafrost on land, which extends out to sea. Permafrost is where the soil is actually frozen. And so you're melting offshore permafrost by warming the offshore waters in summer because they're now ice-free. So it's an entirely new effect that didn't happen until about 10 years ago. So going up there in summer, you now find this ice-free area is releasing methane bubbles. And first of all, the methane was detected dissolved in the water. But then it started to appear actually bubbling out of the sea. This is a Russian group that's working with us. And this is what they found. The sediment at the bottom has melted, the permafrost has melted, and underneath the permafrost there's a massive amount of methane in those sediments in the form of a solid substance called methane hydrate. And the methane hydrate disintegrates when you release the pressure by melting the permafrost, and it comes out. And these are some sonar images of the methane actually coming out in plumes of methane bubbles, just hundreds of them, and forming a kind of whole curtain of methane bubbles coming up to the surface and going out into the atmosphere, which is increasing global warming. And each year that they go out there, there's more of this. There's more methane bubbles. There's more a bigger area where this is happening. So what's it doing to the planet? Well, at the moment, methane levels in the global atmosphere have started to rise again. They seem to have reached a kind of flat limit. Nobody quite knew why they'd stopped rising, but they did stop rising in about the year 2000, and we had nearly a decade of steady methane levels. Two German methane measuring stations showed levels starting to rise again about 2008. And these are methane levels measured throughout the atmosphere by a couple of satellites that can sense the level of methane in the atmosphere. And there's a lot more methane in the Arctic atmosphere in the later satellite pictures than the earlier ones. So it does look as if the methane that's coming up offshore off Siberia is actually contributing to a methane increase globally. Methane, of course, spreads all around the atmosphere very fast, so it's hard to tell where it comes from. This is a global map of methane from a satellite, and we can see there's more methane in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. The levels are about 10% higher in the northern hemisphere, and it suggests that there's an increased and enhanced source of methane somewhere in the northern hemisphere, and so we think that might be the Arctic. In Cambridge, we modelled what would happen if all the methane that's trapped in these sediments came out very quickly. That may not happen. That would be a worst case, would be that the permafrost melted so fast that all the methane trapped in it was released quickly. But if it were, then it would cause an increase in global warming by about 0.6 of a degree, which means we're doubling the amount of warming that the Earth has received just within a few years. So it would be a real disaster. You know, it's like going into debt and then taking on even more debt. You just don't want to do that. So we think that the threat of a methane outbreak will be to make global warming worse very quickly. And so we hope it doesn't happen, of course. And then we estimated what the costs of this would be. We're working with an economist who works with the model that's used in the Stern Review of Climate Change, and he estimated it's going to cost the world $60 trillion over 100 years. But, you know, you can't believe anything that economists say, but it will cost a lot anyway. The figure is very, very high. And most recent work, this is work done this last summer, has shown that this source of methane is over a bigger area than we thought, that the Norwegians have gone into the western part of the Arctic, the Kara Sea, and found methane plumes there. And the Swedes worked in the Laptev Sea, that's halfway round, and found methane plumes in the Laptev Sea. And in fact, they described them as an Arctic methane mega flare. So instead of just the East Siberian Sea, we're seeing these methane emissions all around the shallow waters of the Arctic, the East Siberian Sea, the Laptev Sea, and the Kara Sea. So the area is bigger than we thought. So we really have to worry about that. And longer term, you have to worry about methane emitted from permafrost on land, because the permafrost on land is also melting, but more slowly, and that's releasing methane. So over a long period, you'll get increased methane emissions from all the tundra which has permafrost at the moment. And we've seen rises in temperature of permafrost wherever we look. So methane is a real threat, and it's an immediate threat. We have to keep going up there every year to see how much the methane plumes are increasing. Finally, in the tale of woe, there's the problem of food. What seems to be happening is there's a link between the retreat of sea ice and extreme weather events. And this is, the newspapers have been full of this sort of thing, that we've been getting weird winter weather in Europe and North America, and it's associated with the retreat of sea ice. The reason is that you're warming the Arctic, and that's changing the position of the jet stream. The jet stream is the boundary between Arctic air masses and lower latitude air masses, and it has big loops in it. If the Arctic's warming up, which it is, and the tropics are not warming up so fast, then the temperature difference between the Arctic and the tropics is decreasing. So the Earth is losing part of this temperature gradient between the Arctic and the tropics, and that's causing winds to slow down. So as the jet stream slows down, it adopts bigger loops because it's not moving so fast. And the bigger loops mean that Arctic air can come down into North America, can come down into Europe, while tropical air can move up into places that it never used to be, the Midwest of America and other parts of the world. So the bigger loops on the jet stream mean that some parts of the world get more extreme cold weather in winter, and other parts get more extreme warm weather. So the parts that get more extreme cold weather, say, the people there say, well, global warming isn't happening because we're getting colder weather. But in fact, as a whole, the planet's getting warmer weather, but it's just distributed in a new way. And the trouble is, those big loops that are changing the masses of air that different countries are getting, unfortunately, they interact with all the best crop-producing areas of the world. So these are the areas of croplands which have the highest productivity, and we can see it's a mid-latitude range through North America, Europe, into Russia. There's a lot of crops there which are affected by the jet stream, which is looping along up here, changing its pattern, and those crops are threatened. Not only do we get serious impacts from the ice retreat causing these jet stream to change, but in the long run, we'll get a reduction in production from crops just because of warming. And one of the reasons why politicians say we mustn't let temperatures rise beyond 2 degrees is that as soon as you get more warming, up to 3 or 4 degrees, the productivity of the major food crops in the world goes down. Some of them go up because you're getting more CO2 encourages growth. So for a little while, we actually get more food production from rice and wheat. But once it gets warmer than that, it goes down rapidly. And 4 degrees is what at the moment is predicted for the end of the century. So by the end of the century, we'll have several tens of percent less production of the main food crops, and that's at a time when the global population is increasing very fast. So the collision between global population increase and global food production decrease once you get beyond 2 degrees is a very serious one. I mean, it's one where a lot of people will starve, billions of people will starve. So it's very, very serious that we should not allow global temperatures to rise beyond 2 degrees. It's not just an arbitrary figure pulled out of thin air. It is the figure that determines whether crop production goes up or goes down. So already we're getting global drought occurring more frequently than in the past, and the price of food is already going up. The final, a happy note, our warming is being reduced by an effect which is also due to sea ice retreating. There's a very slow circulation in the world ocean called the thermohaline circulation. It's not related to winds, it's related to temperatures and evaporation. And it's got a section in the northern Atlantic, which is bringing heat in the Gulf Stream up from the tropical Atlantic to Europe, making us warmer than we would otherwise be. So we're about 5 to 10 degrees warmer than we ought to be. And part of what drove that circulation was that water coming up to the high latitudes sank down to the seabed in a place in the middle of the Greenland Sea called the Odden Ice Tongue. And that was due to the ice cover in the Greenland Sea, the Arctic ice cover coming down the east coast of Greenland, turning around and forming an area of, because of currents, forming an area of cold water where ice was forming. And as the ice formed, salt that was in the ocean didn't get incorporated into the ice, but just went back into the ocean, increased the salinity of the ocean. The ocean got more, water got more dense, and it sank. And it sank in a really interesting way, which we were studying until we ran out of research funds, called chimneys, which were the surface water was sinking down to 2,500 meters of the ocean down towards the seabed in the form of a kind of cylinder, a rotating cylinder of sinking water. And you were getting those in this area called the Odden in the middle of the Greenland Sea. And we were studying that and finding this was what was driving this thermohaline circulation. But then suddenly the Odden stopped being there because of global warming. The Odden ice tongue doesn't form anymore. And so the chimneys are not forming. And the result, according to modellers, is going to be this. By the end of the century, the warming of most of continental Europe, including Italy, will be about 4 degrees, and that's going to be disastrous for crops, and a lot of things with life are going to be much harder. It's going to be a bit like North Africa. So most of continental Europe is going to warm by about 4 degrees by the end of the century. But this effect on the thermohaline circulation of the chimneys not forming anymore will keep the Atlantic cooler, and that will limit the warming for countries like Britain, Iceland, Western France, Holland, Norway, and they will only get about 2 to 3 degrees. So it's still quite serious, but of course the price is that the tropical ocean will warm more rapidly, so you have a lot more and worse hurricanes in the south. So there we are. It's mainly a very bad story. And what's happening is that global warming driven by CO2 is doing all these things to the planet. The Arctic is making things worse because the Arctic amplification of warming means that Arctic sea ice is retreating faster. And then all that open water that used to be ice covered is having all these impacts on global sea level rise, on global albedo, and on methane emissions. It's the villain is us by putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but the impact is done via the Arctic. The Arctic's getting the most warming, and then it's doing all these other things to the planet. So what do we do? And of course, we should be stopping emitting carbon dioxide, but there's no sign that people are going to do that. And these are things that might put a kind of sticking plaster on global warming for a while. And it's techniques called geoengineering, which have been proposed, but we don't know if they'll work. And they consist of either going up into the upper atmosphere and deliberately putting powder into the stratosphere to reflect solar radiation. So you have to keep flying up there with high-flying aircraft, releasing this powdered material into the upper atmosphere. Or there's another method that's been proposed of called cloud brightening, where you take the grey, miserable clouds that are typical of Britain, for instance, and you spray very fine water vapour into them through vertical columns, and that whitens them and increases their albedo to offset global warming. So there are technical methods that would slow down global warming, but in the long run, we have to stop emitting carbon dioxide, which means changing the way we live. And the question is, can we do that fast enough? Can we get geoengineering methods that will work quickly enough to offset global warming before we get to some catastrophic level? That's the challenge that we face which is partly coming from the Arctic, and so that's why the Arctic is important.
That was part two of a one-hour talk by Professor Peter Wadams on Arctic amplification, climate change, global warming, new challenges from the top of the world. He spoke in Milano, Italy, on May 29, 2015. Peter Wadams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist. He has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions, working from ice camps, icebreakers, and aircraft. He made 6 submerged voyages to the North Pole on Royal Navy submarines. Wadham's research group in Cambridge has been the only UK group with the capacity to carry out field work on sea ice. Come to TUC Radio's website for more information. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
If you are sharing and doing your fair share, and you are watching other people who are benefiting to a greater extent than you are by basically being out for themselves at others' expense, you start to feel like a sucker. You know, if everybody's going to be doing their share, then people usually don't have a hard time motivating themselves to do their share, or at least there's a tremendous move in that direction.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hinnell. This is segment 2 in a 4-part series about the economy. On this week's show, we talk about progressive movements and the compatibility of having a social economy side by side with a capitalist economy. So stay tuned.
We are listening to Latin Waves. We're very privileged to be joined by Dr. Robin Hinnell. Dr. Robin Hinnell is an economist and a very cherished contributor to Latin Waves. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Now, we've been talking about what an economy is. We ended our last segment talking about the gains and the advancements that, you know, social movements have achieved in Latin America, particularly the case of Venezuela. And we ended the segment talking about the role of transforming not just the economy, but the kind of economy that we create. You your last words were populist redistributive capitalism cannot be sustainable. I'd like to pick up that conversation and perhaps talk a little bit about the structures that form and sustain an economy that is participatory, that allows redistribution of wealth to be equitable and sustained over a long time.
How do you organize an economy so that it will perform well for ordinary people? And my fundamental answer has been that you have to figure out how you can put ordinary people in charge of the economy. One whole vision is the elites will run the economy because it's too complicated for ordinary people to actually manage, control, and make decisions. Elites are going to have to do it. Now, if the elites are doing it, there's two possibilities. They'll run it in a way that serves their interests, even if it doesn't serve the interests of other people. Or you can hope that you will have an elite basically committed to running things in a way that's going to be to the benefit of ordinary people. And I think as soon as you phrase it that way, as soon as you understand what that second option is, it's easy to see why it is a dangerous and unstable option. Because as long as the elites are controlled, they can always move in the direction of doing less and less to make decisions to serve the interests of ordinary people and to do more and more to serve their own interests. You can think of it in terms of social movements. So in Latin America, 21st century progressive movements basically pioneered a new strategy. We're going to build up large social movements and popular organizations. But these are not electoral vehicles. These aren't electoral political parties. These aren't elected politicians. We are also going to work with elected politicians and political parties because out in the streets, street heat essentially can create conditions for changes in economic decisions. But unless you have people who've been elected to government and government officials who are making the changes that are dictated by the masses of people in these social or in these social movements, then you actually don't win anything. So Latin America pioneered, first we built social movements, and then we engage in political activity, and we elect politicians to start doing the bidding of the social movements. And that was always a difficult interface. What's the relationship between the elected politicians and the political parties and the social movements? And scads has been written on this subject. How do the politicians continue to sort of do what the social movements want? And I think one of the things we're observing is that 30 years of social movements electing others to serve their interest as the elected politicians has taken its toll. It takes its toll in the most obvious way in terms of corruption, that elected politicians simply become corrupt. The more important thing is that the elected politicians sort of, they lose contact, and this is another thing that's often noted. Well, they lose contact with the masses. You know, they're elected and they go off and they sit in meetings and somehow they forget where they came from. They forget what they were supposed to do. Well, this is a problem with the strategy. On the other hand, I think it's a problem we have to figure out, you know, better ways of coping with. In the end, we don't want to have to rely on elites, even if they began as elites that were serving the interests of the social movements. You want the social movements actually making the decisions themselves. That's the only thing that's safe in the long run. But in the meantime, we do. I don't think we're going to go back to the days of guerrilla revolutionary armed revolt, you know, in underdeveloped countries as the way to overthrow imperialism and capitalism and to build socialism. I think that Latin America has basically demonstrated that the route to eliminating capitalism in the 21st century is one that's going to start with stronger and stronger social movements. It's going to go through a phase where we're going to elect political parties that will start to implement policies that benefit people, and thereby we increase our strength and confidence. But at some point, we have to figure out how it is that we're no longer relying on elites, even if they are our own political elites and elected political elites, to make the decisions for us. We have to make that next step that nobody has made, or else we are at risk of being, we're at risk of rollback. And that's the kind of thing that we are now observing under somewhat more difficult global conditions in Latin America right now.
So what are the institutions that are intricately defining and regulating how that economy of a particular country functions? For instance, you know, the system of taxation, the system of production. How do we engage with those questions in a way that are accessible? Because part of the reason why we have elites running economies is because we are told economics are too complicated, you know, we need a simple tax system, we need, you know, and there's all these ways that we distance ways of knowing and seeing the world in order to create privilege and privilege in hierarchies that continue to recreate the same forms of domination, repression, and oppression that reinstate inequality and injustice over and over and over.
Let's look at what they did in Venezuela. I think the strategy was actually very, very good up to a certain point. Chavez did not originally say that he was opposed to capitalism. He said he was opposed to neoliberal capitalism. He was opposed to the kind of capitalism that doesn't work for 85% of Venezuelans. And he said, I'm serious and I'm going to do something about it. So the first phase was populist and redistributive. The people who were most benefited by the reforms of the first 3 or 4 years of the Chavez government, I lived and worked in Venezuela 2 or 3 different times for short periods. And what I came to understand was we're talking about a woman in her 30s or her 40s who is certainly largely of African descent, who is a single mom and who is living in a slum. And Chavez benefited those women and their families in very palpable ways. They got health care. They got food at prices they could afford. They got educational opportunities, both for themselves in terms of adult literacy and for their children. These were tremendous improvements in human lives. What those women came and said to the Chavez government at a certain point was, we appreciate this. We've got your back. If the oligarchy tries to overthrow you, we will go in the streets. We will not put up with that because we know this is the first government that has ever done anything for us and our kind of people. But you know what I need now? I need a job. And at that point, the private industry and the private sector in Venezuela was still completely in the hands of either foreign multinational companies or in the hands of a very reactionary political bourgeoisie, which was doing everything it could to sabotage the economy and create conditions that would get Chavez out of power. So the thing he did at that point was he said, yes, well, the next step is we need to give these people jobs. And we're going to give them jobs in a new form of political organization. We're going to help them organize workers' cooperatives. Because A, the state sector can't hire them all. And B, the private sector is refusing to. So we're going to go ahead and have a massive program to create workers-owned and managed cooperatives that these kinds of people who have become engaged in the political revolution can get involved in. And it was a very good idea, and they did. They created tons of cooperatives. There was huge international criticism. Oh, but the failure rate of your cooperatives is so high. You're making loans, you're going out and organizing people to set up their own businesses and go to work, and you're making loans to these businesses and get off the ground, but it's very difficult to train people and give them the accounting skills that they need in order to do this. You have huge failure rates. And I thought Chavez's answer was brilliant. He said, you know what's important? What's important is not how many fail. What's important is how many actually don't fail. And I'm going to create lots and lots so we have many, many that don't fail. So They did that for 2 or 3 years, and it was a big step forward. And notice that it also moves us from, I am using oil revenues to give you healthcare clinics, to I am actually empowering you to be a productive person and make decisions about how it is you go about working. The problem with that was that it bogged down, and in part it bogged down because of tremendous opposition from the private sector. In part it bogged down because it is a difficult process. It's difficult to give people the skills they need so that they can actually set up and run their own factories and their own businesses. And it also failed because there was never an answer to the question, but how do these little co-ops and the new communal governments that are making the political process much more participatory and democratic, how do they actually coordinate amongst themselves? They never figured out a way. How can we have some sort of democratic planning of this new economy that we've created? They had a name for it. They called it the social economy. And they said, we have the private economy, we have the old state sectors, such as the oil company, and we now have our new social economy that's made up of these people's communes and of these workers-owned cooperatives and all these health clinics and these food stores that are in the poor neighborhoods. That's our social economy. Well, at some point, that social economy had to grow and it had to consolidate, because you can't just create it and have it sit there. It's going to go one way or the other. And that is, in my opinion, where the failure came in. That after making all these forward steps, there was simply a point that was reached where the social economy was no longer growing, it wasn't consolidating, and instead it was stagnating. And when it started to stagnate, that's when the political power of the oligarchy started to increase, because they still had control of their part of the economy. The government did not go ahead and aggressively say, now we have a social economy that's up and running, it works better for people than the private sector does, we're going to replace the private sector with the social economy. It's going to be that's going to be the economy for the whole country. They needed to move in that direction. For a lot of reasons, it's difficult. But I think what we're seeing is the consequences of that failure. And when I say that failure, I don't mean that it was necessarily a failure of the political leadership even. It was a failure to do something. When you lose that forward momentum, at some point the momentum is going to turn back in the other direction. And that's what started to happen, and has continued to happen, unfortunately.
So can we talk a little bit then about the structure that, because as you point out, we have a social economy that was started, but there seems to be a need for a kind of a structure way to keep moving that momentum into something that it becomes sustained on its own effort. You know what I mean? That it becomes the new normal, because that's how capitalism gets sold to us. It's just normal. You know, if you're going to have an economy, it has to be capitalism.
Part of the reason momentum is so important is, what is it that motivates people in the social economy? Well, basically two things. What motivates them is, we're making the decisions. We're not carrying out decisions that an employer has made, or, you know, that a government bureaucrat has made. We're making the decisions ourselves. And so when we decide to do things, then that's the incentive and the motivation people have to go ahead and get them done. The second thing that motivates people in the social economy and that motivates people in these co-ops is, well, you know, there's a lot of work that isn't very pleasant, but somebody's got to do it, but we're going to share it. We're going to share the burdens of doing the unpleasant things that have to be done for all of us to be able to have the things that we want. So it's sort of a growing sense of what's fair when we're distributing sort of the burdens of economic activity. There's a growing sense of, we're going to do that fairly, and that's why I do my fair share. That's why I show up even when it's hard to get out of bed, because I understand that if I don't do that and then somebody else doesn't do that, it isn't going to work. Those are the things that motivate people in the social economy, the economy of the future. Now, those aren't the things that motivate people in the capitalist sector. In the capitalist sector, it's basically people out after their own individual benefit at the expense of others. So it's very difficult to have those two systems coexist. If you are sharing and doing your fair share, and you are watching other people who are benefiting to a greater extent than you are by basically being out for themselves at others' expense, you start to feel like a sucker. You know, if everybody's going to be doing their share, then people usually don't have a hard time motivating themselves to do their share, or at least there's a tremendous move in that direction. But if people see others not doing their share and taking advantage, then it's very difficult. It's more difficult to get people to do their fair share in the economy. And I think that's one of the reasons that allowing that private sector with its wholly different ethos, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and the losers are the losers, and the winners are the winners. That's the ethos. That's the way of life in capitalist economies. If you don't want that to be the way the economy works, you have to set up an economy that works on different principles. But thinking you can have the two coexist, I think, is a lesson to be learned that, once again, from Venezuela, we've discovered that, no, it's either going to go one way or another. People are either going to start behaving one kind of way or they're going to start behaving the other. You can't have sort of half the people doing one and half the people doing other. That's something that is not sustainable.
Now, in terms of having an economy that functions, can we talk about the role of diversity within an economy that is productive and that fulfills the needs of most people?
I'll put it this way. All economic research indicates that when people have more say over how things should be done, then the people who do those things are more productive. If you increase participation, you almost always increase productivity. Now, that's a huge advantage. If we're talking about workers-owned co-ops, it means that as long as those workers-owned co-ops are being run in a way where people are effectively participating in the decision-making, then there's every reason to believe, from all the economic evidence we have, that they will be more productive. They'll be more dedicated to getting things done. When a problem comes up at work, there's two attitudes I can have. One is, it's not my problem. Somebody else is going to have to solve it. I sort of look the other way. And the other attitude I can have is, ooh, this problem's come up. We've got to do something about that. Well, that means I have to do something about that. Well, the evidence indicates that when people are more involved in participating in the decision-making process, they're more likely to take that second attitude and not the first attitude. So that's part of the reason that there is, I think, an inherent advantage in terms of how well the economy can operate. If it's not operated when employers are just telling people what they have to do and people are doing as little as they possibly can and still collect their wage rate. When you think about it, does that sound like a recipe for a productive economy? It doesn't. It's amazing that the proponents of capitalism have basically claimed that that's the best way to run an economy for all these years. The other part of the problem is most people have lived their entire lives in a context where they weren't supposed to be making economic decisions. They were being told that somebody else is supposed to be making these decisions for them. So that's a huge change in people's attitude. And it's not just a question of technical education and providing people with courses in accounting. It's also a sort of a political education that has to counter literally centuries of people being told that they're not really capable of making good economic decisions. Then the other thing you have to do is you have to set up sensible procedures so that people, ordinary people, can make good economic decisions. And that's where you have to come up with some system of coordinating all of these workers-owned enterprises and consumers and neighborhoods. You have to figure out some way of coordinating them so that it doesn't take a tremendous amount of their time, it doesn't overtax them, it provides them with the necessary information to make simple decisions about, yes, we prefer this to that, here are the options, here are the consequences, here's the vote, we're done, moving on. You have to figure out ways to do that. And that's something that, that socialist revolutionaries and leadership of anti-capitalist movements, you know, quite frankly, haven't really provided people with answers that everybody's agreed on.
I love your response that when people feel engaged, when people feel included, they're more apt to take, you know, responsibility over creating something that collectively benefits the whole. And I'd like to leave our conversation for this segment there, because I think that this really is a nice platform to jump into our third segment, which is what are the barriers that prevent, you know, this ability to co-create. So we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for being with us.
We're going to finish today's show with a song by Dana Lyons called My Tiny Room. Thanks for listening.
There are flowers on my windowsill, and everyone looks like the sun. The sun is within everyone, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are bees in the flowers, rolling in pollen and fun. The sun is within everyone, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are children out my window. They laugh and they squeal as they run. The sun is within everyone. I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are soldiers out my window, all of them daughters and sons. A sun is within everyone, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. Weapons that shine like the sun, where all life is fragile and one, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. I see God out my window, and I see that God shines like the sun. Another spring day has begun, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are flowers on my windowsill, and everyone looks like the sun.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.